maniacs. I'm all pumped up, Jack. Well, you didn't think I'd let all my maniacs celebrate the Riyadh season without the Hawks, did you?
The Riyadh season.
Better get ready. I'm bringing these 24-inch pythons to Riyadh for the WWE Crown Jewel on October 31st. So what you gonna do when the Riyadh season, WWE Crown Jewel, and Hulkamania run wild on you, brother? Brah.
What year is this?
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
A little bit of the bubbly.
Mama Monster.
Conquered the street.
We like fighting a woman.
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
Come over here and fight me.
Delete. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
I am a one-man wrecking crew.
Yes, indeed. Sweet Saudi Money 4, No Dignity, No Doubt. Shout out to John. Will take place on Halloween. Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair will be there. What do you think is more likely? WWE sending Ric Flair to Raw tomorrow night to be attacked by The Fiend? Or sending him to Saudi Arabia and just leaving him there as payback for threatening to sue them? This is episode 619 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, September 29th, 2019. I am the Solid Monster, and wishing a very happy new year to all of my Jewish listeners who are celebrating tonight and tomorrow. I could not have timed episode 619 and the end of my Rey Mysterio countdown any better. Mysterio won a fatal five-way on Monday night to earn a Universal title match against Safe Space Rollins tomorrow, who deactivated his Twitter account a few days ago. Possibly because some Sasha Banks fans replied to a dig that he posted about her, and in turn they said mean things about him. Some people claim that he received death threats, which is never cool, but I have no idea if that's true. I couldn't tell you what he even posted, for obvious reasons. But it offended him greatly, and so his account disappeared. This is the man that Rey Mysterio is challenging for the championship tomorrow night. And this is the end of my countdown as the eight best matches of Rey Mysterio's career, covering number two and covering match number one at the end of the podcast this week. But first, strap on. Here we go. This is the, or strap in, I should say. Or strap on. Whatever floats your boat, I suppose. This is the tentative schedule for this week. I am going to plan on having a Raw review, a Sound Off Extra Raw review, up on YouTube early Tuesday morning. Now, that will not be live because that territory belongs to someone else. I also don't think I can do an early Raw review like this every week. But I want to do one this week. I want to see how late I'm up with it, and then we'll go from there. So that might be something for you to watch for early on Tuesday morning. Wednesday night, of course, is the debut of AEW on TNT. It is the first head-to-head battle between AEW and NXT. I'll be going live on YouTube after both shows are over to review AEW. I can't review both. So the plan is to review the first AEW show. I'll flip. You know, obviously I'll do what a lot of you used to do during the Raw and Nitro days when they were head-to-head. You know, you flip around, or one show goes to a commercial, you flip over to another one. So I'll be flipping around like a lot of you will be. Catch what I can of NXT. And then I'll catch up with the rest of the show later on. So this will, again, be more of an AEW live stream, which may become a weekly fixture on the channel. I kind of look at this week coming up as a nice little trial run for what might be. And I will try also to have predictions up on YouTube for Hell in a Cell, which is coming up a week from today. I'll try to have that up by sometime later on Thursday, early Friday if I can. I like to try to get those predictions up a few days early if possible. Friday, starting at 5 p.m., I will be joining JD from NY, John Draper, and Julian Cannon for a special meetup post-Comic-Con that day, which I cannot make this year because I'll be working, but I will be there for the meetup at the Monroe Pub in Brooklyn, 481 Fifth Avenue. in Brooklyn. It's a British pub in the heart of Brooklyn. What's not to like? They're going to have happy hour specials through 7 p.m., and they will put SmackDown on the TV at 8 p.m. for those who want to stick around. I know Draper's going to be staying. I'll be heading out, but you can watch the premiere of SmackDown on Fox with him if you'd like to stick around. I know Julian is going to be giving away some goodies as well during the event, so it's going to be a fun time. My SmackDown thoughts I'll be saving for the podcast next Sunday, so there won't be any live streams for that one. But if you're coming from Comic-Con, or you know, even if you're not, open up a Lyft account. You can use Lyft to get to the bar and save a few bucks by using our code. And that code is very simple, Solomonster. So use the code Solomonster when you open up a new account with Lyft. And if you don't get your entire ride for free, you can at least get a few bucks off. I don't promote that enough. So I said, you know, we're having an event. It costs you nothing. You'll save money in the process, so why not mention it? That brings us then to Saturday. I will be at the House of Glory show in Queens for its C4 show doing commentary. The Lucha Bros defend the HOG tag team titles. Mick Foley is making an appearance for a signing. Rikishi will be there doing a meet and greet as well. You can get tickets. There are still some tickets available. Go to hogwrestling.net. And finally, next Sunday will be episode 620 of The Sound Off. And then later on that night is the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view, which means I'll be going live on YouTube with my thoughts immediately after. Somewhere in between, I will find a few seconds to quietly sulk in the corner and eat a cupcake with a candle in it for my birthday. As I turn 1 year older, working on my birthday. Now, the last time the podcast fell on my birthday was the same month that Ryback wrestled CM Punk inside Hell in a Cell. So we're going back a ways. So it's going to be a busy week. I hope you'll join me for all of the insanity. I also hope you'll sign up for an Audible trial. We've had kind of a slow month, so I want everybody to go right now. Go to audibletrial.com/solomonster. You can sign up for a 30-day trial of the service. It does not cost you anything, especially if you cancel for any reason before those 30 days are up. But the cool thing is you get something for free. You get one free audiobook that you get to keep no matter what. And it doesn't have to be wrestling related if you don't want it to be. Just go to audibletrial.com/solomonster. And of course, you can become a PayPal VIP. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out here on the show. You can go to thesolomonster.com and you will see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. And always remember that if you need to use an email address, you can always use an email to make a donation as well. The email is thesolomonster@gmail.com. Thank you to Chuck Lunatic Lentz. I've not heard from Chuck in a while. And then he goes ahead and drops a little birthday bomb on me this week. So thank you, my friend. The Bangkok Bandit, Nipit Viramatikal. Nipit, thank you. You're awesome. The Cleric of Destruction, Eric Zings. Another international listener whose generosity is most appreciated. The Portland Pop Star, Paul Hamilton, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, the Florida Freebird, Brian Pissarra, Killshot Keith Hart, Stephen Handyman Halistick, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eicher, the Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T, the Anarchist Andrew Heller, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Bakersfield Brawler Kevin Velato, Billy Hardcore Habibi, Bear Claw Wendell Baugh, I love that name, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, Mr. Atlanta Lively Chris Matthews, Big League Brady Terry, Josh the Shooter Stockton, the Rabbit King Christian Die, and El Hijo del Solomonster, Jose Pili. Thank you all. Also want to give a shout out to Rudy and his wife Nancy, who is going in for cancer surgery tomorrow. I'm thinking about you both and hope everything goes well. Kick its ass and then wake it back up and kick its ass again. And wishing a very happy birthday today to Radiant Ray Wrighton, who I know is very dejected. She is down in the dumps. about turning 30, and I would give you the usual speech about how, well, you know, they say 40 is the new 30 and 30 is the new 20, but that's bullshit.
I don't know how to respond to that.
Oh my goodness. As I'm doing the birthday shout-out, Siri is talking to me. Hey Siri. Can you wish a happy birthday to RJ?
I don't see RJ in your contacts. Who do you want to send it to?
No, I'm not sending anything. I want you to wish a happy birthday to RJ.
I don't see RJ in your contacts. Who do you want to send it to?
No. Today is RJ's birthday.
Really? Well then, happy birthday.
There you go. Say even Siri is wishing you a happy birthday. Thank you, Siri. RJ, happy birthday. 30 is nothing to sweat. Been there, done that. I hope you have an awesome day. You've been a loyal listener for a long time. Don't be sad. It'll be a happy day. Birthdays are a happy day. I have a birthday next week. I'm older than you are. I'm not sad. You gotta be happy. So, happy birthday to RJ. And lastly, shout out to Big Hodge Media NYC on YouTube. This guy is the real deal. The work that he does for House of Glory alone, I would put their vignettes and their videos ahead of almost any indie in the country. Frankly, it looks better than even some of the promotions that you'll see on television. That is due to the work that this man does. I've gotten the chance to get to know him a little bit, hopefully more in the future. And I cannot say enough good things about his talent. He has a YouTube channel. You should all check it out, especially if you want to know the ins and outs of production and filmography. He goes into that a little bit. He's got a podcast now as well. Check him out on YouTube, Big Hodge Media NYC. And 559 Dodger, thank you for the love on iTunes. I watched the WWE Untold mini-documentary on the network titled, That's Gotta Be Kane, That's Gotta Be Kane. It's a little over half an hour long. It covers the lead-up to the first ever Hell in a Cell match between Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker from 1997, and the debut of Kane. It includes interviews with Shawn Michaels. They have a phone interview on there with The Undertaker, a sit-down interview with Glenn Jacobs, where he gets very emotional at the end. I'm sure you've seen that clip circulating on social media. He gets very emotional at the end, talking about a sick kid that he had met in the hospital who had passed away. Definitely check this one out. It's really good. And you get a sense of what was going on behind the scenes at the time as well. We get to see some of the original artwork, the original sketches of what Vince McMahon envisioned the Kane character would look like. He wanted him basically to look like this muscled up superhero with a cape and everything. Remember, capes always make things better, right? I said I say this a few weeks ago. I think I even threatened to wear a cape one of these weeks on cam during the live streams. But in fact, Kane did wear a cape, as some of you know, at least for one night. There's that photo of him wearing a cape. It might have been in Madison Square Garden before they ditched it. But what this also reminded me of, and we can talk about some of the greatest WrestleMania matches of all time, right? Including Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker at WrestleMania 25 and other matches like Bret Hart against Stone Cold Steve Austin at WrestleMania 13, which may be the greatest match in company history. Also from 1997. Imagine having a year with that match and this first Hell in a Cell match being produced by the same company and not thinking that WWE had a better product than WCW did. I will fight that battle. I fought that battle mightily, walking home from school with my friend every single day who would argue with me until, you know, his last breath about how WCW was so much better than the WWF was. You can look at matches like Bret and Stone Cold, or Shawn and Razor at WrestleMania 10, or Bret Hart and the British Bulldog at Wembley at SummerSlam, or Randy Savage against the Ultimate Warrior at WrestleMania 7. I could go on. But this match here, the first Hell in a Cell, if this is not the greatest match in WWE history, it's damn close. I think I bought I did a buy or sell a few weeks ago in the mailbag. And I think I bought on Bret Hart against Owen Hart in the cage at SummerSlam in 94 over this one. That was a tough call because I love them both. So I personally, I can go either way on those, either one of those matches being the greatest. But here, you have one of the greatest matches with the single greatest character debut in company history. Even still, over 20 years later, you will not find me a debut in WWE better than Kane's debut here in 97. I mean, Chris Jericho in 99 had a great debut. Taz had a great debut. The Nexus on Monday Night Raw. Even The Fiend this year had a memorable debut at SummerSlam. Great entrance and everything. They're all playing runner-up to Kane's debut at Bad Blood. Michaels and The Undertaker, they had great chemistry working together. Big man against the annoying little man who would sell and bump his ass off for him. You know, they even said in the documentary, Michaels' job was very simple. Shawn Michaels' job was to go out there and to get his ass kicked for 20 minutes. And he did his job well. And I remember thinking how cool it was to see these two in the ring together, you know, for the first time, one-on-one, the month before at that Ground Zero pay-per-view. Because in all the years that these two spent, you know, in the company, Undertaker going back to 1990 and Shawn going back even earlier than that, to, I think to 88 or so, when they initially, the Rockers, first came to WWE. All the years that these two guys spent working in the same company together, it was very odd how their paths had never crossed at all before. It was like the last great big match that hadn't been done. And the Hell in a Cell match and their matches at WrestleMania, you know, later on kind of overshadow what I think is a really good match that they had in September that year at Bad Blood. Or, I'm sorry, not Bad Blood, at Ground Zero. At that Ground Zero pay-per-view. But everything about this match here, from the story going in, Michaels accidentally costing Undertaker the championship at SummerSlam, turning on the fans who he felt had turned against him, forming DX. You know, you've got this little side angle going on where Paul Bearer, for months, going back, I think, to June, had been teasing that The Undertaker had a little brother and that his brother, who was supposedly burned in a fire many years earlier, was still alive. So you've got these two angles happening at one time. Then you have the match itself. First time ever, locked like rats inside this giant cage with a top on it. Michaels is bleeding all over the place. Very violent, especially by WWE standards at that time. A very violent, bloody match. So you have the story, the characters, the match itself, the violence, just the spectacle of it all. And the cherry on the top of the sundae was the Kane debut. He just looked, he looked the part. He looked like a scary monster. As big as The Undertaker, all jacked up, the badass mask, the red and black, you know, shooting fire out of the ring posts. I mean, who the hell could have predicted that the guy who played Isaac Yankem and Fake Diesel, which they cover in the documentary, would go on to have another 20 years in this company as a Hall of Famer. Not me. I figured he'd be the flavor of the month big man for The Undertaker to beat at WrestleMania, and then he'll disappear. Then it's off to the scrap heap with him. I was happy to be wrong. You know, this original version of Kane, and also I think the Kane who we saw who came back in very early 2000, those two incarnations of Kane, the Kane that was laying waste to DX and the McMahon-Helmsley faction, you know, when he came back, is probably the most badass monster type that the company has ever had, bar none. That Kane from back then makes Braun Strowman and The Fiend, who I love, but he makes them and the current roster guys today, you know, if Kane was, you know, if Kane is a Rottweiler, he makes the rest of them look like Pomeranians. You know, they're cute. They're cute. And they think they're all that, but they would be devoured. Absolutely eaten alive. So go watch this documentary. Kane tells some funny stories about the build-up to the Kane character. They get into the night that Michaels disrespected The Undertaker off-camera during a commercial break on Raw. And basically called out The Undertaker, knowing that The Undertaker was not actually booked for the show and actually in the building that night, and it made him look weak, and it pissed everybody off backstage. You know, he had a knack, Shawn Michaels did back then, for pissing people off. But the problem is, he would piss off all the wrong people. He was a great heel. I mean, he could piss off the audience. But when you piss off your boss and you piss off your coworkers, that's not the right kind of heat. But even though I say Michaels Undertaker Mania 25 is the greatest, you know, WrestleMania match of all time, this may be the better match of the two. If you look at it, you know, from just the total package. And surely, in my opinion, still the greatest Hell in a Cell match of all time. Undertaker and Mankind is... it's hard to grade that one. You know, it's more of a spectacle than anything else. It's almost unfair to grade that match on the same scale as everything else. I guess it just depends on what your criteria is for a great match. Friday night, Ring of Honor held its Death Before Dishonor show in Las Vegas, and I've got a spoiler to share, even though the show already aired, and it's not technically a spoiler. I know some people are allergic to this type of thing. You know, the minute it leaves my lips without their EpiPen, they could die. So stick cotton balls in your ears if you don't want to know. Roosh won the ROH World title from Matt Taven in the main event, days before Taven's contract was set to expire with the company this Tuesday. The next day, CMLL announced that it had fired Roosh and his brother Dragon Lee. There's a lot of political BS going on right now, just in general, not just with CMLL and the Roosh situation, but clearly there's a lot of politics involved here. They will no longer be able to use their names as they are trademarked by CMLL. I believe that may only be in Mexico, though. I think they may be okay here in the States. So, you know, in Ring of Honor, for example, the man who just won their world title should not have to change his name, I don't think. But he's already using the name El Toro Blanco for some shows down in Mexico, which translates to the White Bull. Puts ROH in a weird spot now because... yeah, this guy's their world champion. And it's not as though... look, they have a working relationship with CMLL. So if things are as acrimonious as it sounds they are between Roosh and the CMLL side, it's not as though Ring of Honor can just not book their world champion, right? Or take the title off him immediately. So we'll see if that ends the relationship, if that strains their relationship or not. I guess if they're petty, if CMLL is a petty organization... which I've heard they can be, and they can hold grudges against people, then that probably makes for a very weird situation for ROH to be in. You know, Roosh and Dragon Lee both wrestled on that Death Before Dishonor show. I don't believe Dragon Lee is signed to a contract with Ring of Honor. But, you know, could this be a case like with Impact? You know, Impact telling AAA, for example, not to book Killer Cross on their Madison Square Garden show a few weeks ago. Could this be a similar situation where CMLL flexes or tries to flex its muscle to get ROH to bury Roosh? I mean, given that he's their champion now, I think that's unlikely. I have a hard time believing Ring of Honor would do that, but they are caught in the crossfire here. As for Matt Taven, he has since announced, he announced during the TV tapings for ROH last night, that he will be staying with Ring of Honor. He is not leaving, he has signed a new deal. Yeah, Taven has had some really good matches, you know, to give him credit here, looking back on his title run. He has had some really good matches. He had a really good one at the ROH tapings at Hammerstein over the summer that I attended. This show, too, you know, I didn't get to see the full show, but this match that he had with Roosh the other night apparently was very good. But he was the wrong choice to put the title on at that Madison Square Garden show back in April, which I was also at, and it sucked the life out of that building. What a mistake it was to not put that championship on that night on Marty Scurll. His contract has more time on it than Taven's did. So this whole thing, well, they couldn't put the title on Scurll if they knew he might be leaving and maybe he'll go to AEW. Supposedly, Scurll's contract is not up until November. Taven's contract, before he just re-signed, apparently was up this Tuesday, a month before Scurll's contract. So that's not an excuse anymore as far as why they didn't put the belt on Marty Scurll. But you know, Taven's former tag team partner Mike Kanellis right now is in the middle of a paternity storyline on Monday Night Raw. So I guess we're now spared Matt Taven being revealed as Maria's baby daddy. which is probably as good as it would have gotten for Matt Taven had he gone to WWE and actually made the main roster. It was very cool also seeing Brian Zane of Wrestling with Regret, who I just got done karaokeing with in Vegas over a Double or Nothing weekend. And that video shall not see the light of day. But it was very cool to see him getting either a tryout or maybe it was something more, I don't know. But there he was doing a backstage interview with the Beer City Bruiser and with the Beer City Bruiser and his partner the other night during the show, or on the pre-show rather. That was quite unexpected to see him pop up on my timeline and very cool. And as if all the political stuff with CMLL and Roosh was not enough, and Dragon Lee was not enough, last night, New Japan held its Fighting Spirit Unleashed show here in New York at the Hammerstein Ballroom, and the show almost did not happen. Now, was it an act of sabotage by another promotion? Was it just a fan being a dick and trying to cause problems? Or did the ambulance company forget to put the show on its calendar and now they're just trying to cover their ass? You know what? We don't have all the facts, so I can't say that it was an act of sabotage by another promotion. That didn't stop people from jumping to conclusions, because that's what people do on the internet. Some pretty wild conclusions about who may have been responsible. But what happened is that someone allegedly representing ROH, or not ROH, oops, did I give it away? Someone representing New Japan allegedly called the ambulance company that morning, yesterday morning, the ambulance company that Hammerstein uses to supply ambulances for all of its shows, wrestling, kickboxing, MMA, concerts, and informed the ambulance company that the New Japan show last night, which was sold out, was canceled, even though it was not canceled. And instead of verifying this with New Japan, see, to me, it would make sense that there's a point of contact at all times. I don't know how these companies, I don't know how New Japan or Ring of Honor or any of these companies do this. They can speak more to this, but, you know, if I were running the company or I were working for the company, I would make sure that there's always a POC, always a point of contact. So in a situation like this, where you need to inform them of something, or if you, or as in this case, if let's say the show was legitimately being canceled, there's a designated person who contacts, in this case, the ambulance company, to inform them that the show is canceled, or that the show is going to be running late, or maybe just to call them to verify, hey, we're having a show tonight at this time, we need you here by this time, we just want to call to confirm. And it doesn't sound like anything like that actually happened in this case. The fact that a random person can call, or maybe a random person masquerading as somebody who works for the promotion, and can single-handedly almost ruin and sabotage the entire show, is kind of scary. That there are not systems in place to confirm and verify and prevent this sort of thing from happening. It just sounds like basic 101 common business sense and business practice. But that's not what happened here. And so what happened is New Japan didn't know until the 11th hour that this had happened. Well, the commission in New York will not allow the show to start unless there's an ambulance present outside. So now they're scrambling to find another ambulance at the last minute. It ended up delaying the start of the show by 90 minutes. It was supposed to start around 7. The show didn't start until around 8:30. Gabe Sapolsky chimed in on Twitter. I saw he said, "I hope we find out who's responsible. This needs payback. These dirty tricks belong back in the Carney indie days." And he has since deleted those tweets. Maybe calling for payback wasn't the wisest thing to do. But again, we don't know yet exactly who called, if it was some random stranger just trying to cause problems, or if it is some kind of underhanded act by another promotion, and if it is, then that's pretty slimy and shitty. And I hope that person does get outed. It is now official. Impact Wrestling will be airing Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. on Access Television beginning October 29th. Although Access is going to begin airing Impact-related programming starting this Tuesday, including their Homecoming special from January, and then their Slammiversary special from July will be the next thing that airs. Then on October 22nd, which is the week before the big premiere, their official debut, Josh Matthews and Scott D'Amore will be hosting a two-hour preview special on the 22nd to get viewers familiar with the Impact roster. I said it had to be Tuesdays or Thursdays that Impact would end up on Access. It just made no sense for them to run any other night. Monday made no sense. Wednesday now obviously makes no sense. And Friday doesn't make any sense. If the idea was to run at 10 p.m. after SmackDown and try to pick up some of that SmackDown audience, it would have been a failure. Because people are already, you know, done watching 2 hours of SmackDown. They're not going to turn around and watch another 2 hours from 10 o'clock until midnight. It was a terrible, and on a Friday night, no less. SmackDown may not do that well on Fridays. We'll see. I mean, I'm sure the first show this week will do pretty well. But I wonder what the long-term future of SmackDown in terms of the numbers look like on a night like Friday. So to me, Tuesday or Thursday seem to be the only open nights for Impact that would have made sense. And so now they're running on Tuesdays. Tuesday at 8 is a good place for them to be. It still won't be the only wrestling-related show airing that night. WWE announced this week their hour-long FS1 studio show that night. Is going to be called WWE Backstage. It'll be hosted by Renee Young and Booker T. Starting Tuesday night, November 5th at 11 p.m. It'll run from 11 to midnight. Renee will no longer be doing commentary on Monday Night Raw. She will be limited to the role of special contributor on SmackDown, whatever that means. CM Punk, per PW Insider, there's that name again. You know, every time you think, okay, we're done with the whole CM Punk stuff, there it is. His name pops up yet again. CM Punk, according to PW Insider and The Observer, was at Fox Studios last week to discuss a possible analyst role on the WWE FS1 show. They were shooting some test material with him and with Renee. No word if he is officially signed on to be part of the show, if it's a done deal, or if this really was just a test. Maybe he won't get the part. You know, him being on television, talking about WWE every week, can only mean one thing. The man is hard up for cash. Not that he's destitute or anything like that, or that he's broke. I'm not saying that. But there is no way that he is doing this unless he needs the money. He's been gone now, what, almost 6 years? WWE bled him dry. Well, maybe they didn't bleed him dry, but they bled him out with that lawsuit. He tried the MMA thing. That didn't work out, although he did get paid nicely for it, for those couple of fights that he had. It only makes sense that he'd want to go for the payday, because if he does come back for this, you have to think that he ends up back in the ring for them at some point in the not-too-distant future. This is the first step. The first step is him coming back, even if it's through Fox technically and not signing a contract directly with WWE. If he's going to be on television every week talking about WWE, he'll be back in the ring with them at some point. I guarantee it. PW Insider says that Fox auditioned others as well for the analyst role, including Taz and Sean Waltman. And apparently Paige was also in for an audition as well. So they're probably going to have a rotating team of analysts like a lot of those Fox Sports shows do or ESPN shows do. And we shall see if Punk is officially added. They'll make that announcement very soon if that's the case. You know, you look at the new weekly schedule of wrestling on television, and there is no way that anyone who wants to maintain any kind of social life could possibly watch all of this. We've got Raw on Mondays, Impact on Access and the FS1 show now on Tuesdays. Head-to-head, NXT with AEW on Wednesdays. NXT UK is moving shortly to Thursdays. SmackDown on Fox on Fridays, followed by 205 Live, which is also moving to Friday nights immediately after SmackDown, at least temporarily. MLW Fusion, which doesn't get enough love, on beIN Sports on Saturdays, plus also on Saturday nights, you have a block of the WOW Women of Wrestling show and New Japan on Access. Then you've got the syndicated Ring of Honor show every weekend for those who have a Sinclair station in their market, although I know you can watch them online as well. And don't forget the new NWA show begins taping this week. And none of this includes the monthly WWE pay-per-views on Sundays, AEW pay-per-views every few months on Saturdays, and the NXT and NXT UK takeover specials on the network. So pick your poison. You'll have plenty of wrestling to choose from starting this week. One setback that Impact will have to recover from is losing its vice president of production. John Pollock of Post Wrestling first reported that Kevin Sullivan, and no, it's not that Kevin Sullivan, but this is a different Kevin Sullivan. Kevin Sullivan gave his notice recently to the company that he would be leaving. And his new destination? All Elite Wrestling. AEW has poached him away from Impact, and he is said to be bringing a handful of staff members from the production team with him to AEW. SEScoops.com followed up with their own sources who claimed that Impact was blindsided by the news that the company has hired a Tennessee-based producer to take over and help them regroup. They have a little bit of time before the official move to Access on October 29th to get their house in order. But not the sort of thing you want to have happen right before you move to a new network. A lot of Access folks lost their jobs when Anthem took over. I don't know how many of them were on the production side. I know some of them at least were. But now it looks like Impact could use some of those same people to get their own situation sorted out. The day is nearly upon us. AEW Dynamite premieres live on TNT this Wednesday at 8, 7 Central, head-to-head with 2 hours of NXT on USA. An NXT on USA episode that resembles more of an NXT takeover card with limited commercial interruption. So AEW is going to have to bring its best on Wednesday. For months, we have heard these guys. We've heard Cody. We've heard Kenny. We've heard Tony Khan. We've heard Jim Ross. We've heard the Young Bucks. All talk about revolutionizing professional wrestling and changing the landscape of professional wrestling and using all of these words to, you know, really hype up the debut of the television show and the rise of this new promotion. Using words that you would hope they are able to back up. Now they get their opportunity to sink or swim. Now they get their chance to deliver on what they promised. The time for talk is over. The time for all of the hyperbole is done. Now they have to go out and deliver. That's the hard part. This is what the card looks like, barring whatever surprises they may have in store. CM Punk obviously not being one of them. So hopefully we can put that to bed. Not only does it not sound like CM Punk will be doing anything with AEW, it sounds like AEW does not want to have anything to do with CM Punk. It actually sounds like there's some heat there on both sides. So I would not look for him to be on the show this Wednesday. According to Cody, the TV show is going to be rated TV-14. So they may have some leeway that WWE does not have as a PG program to push the envelope a little bit more. But the rating really is inconsequential. You know, you can put on a great PG show if you just make it entertaining enough. But I know a lot of people are going to have that funny feeling in their tighty-whities when they see that little TV-14 box pop up in the corner of their screen. So hopefully they have a towel nearby. Jim Ross, Excalibur, and Tony Schiavone are expected to be the three-man booth for the TV show. JR and Schiavone together is going to be very interesting as far as who takes over more of the play-by-play role, or is it Excalibur? You know, we've heard him do a little bit of play-by-play as well. You know, Jim Ross obviously is an experienced play-by-play guy, as is Tony Schiavone. In their more recent roles, they really have not played just the straight play-by-play guy, even on the MLW show. You know, Schiavone is almost like just more of kind of a color guy. And Jim Ross has played that role as well, to an extent, towards the end of his WWE run and even early on here at AEW. But, you know, do they share in the play-by-play duties? What kind of chemistry do they have after all these years? It's going to be very cool on that first show to see the two of them working together in the same booth. If you're Excalibur, you probably have to be on cloud nine. This guy's going to be sitting between JR and Schiavone. If he's a longtime wrestling fan, I'm sure that's going to be a cool feeling for him. So I'm very much looking forward to seeing what kind of chemistry they have together at the announce booth. Cody takes on Sammy Guevara in what is expected to be the opening match. In part, Cody says, so that he can then go backstage when the match is over and he can sit down on headset with Tony Khan and help run the rest of the show. I had thought that this would be a good plan. I said this a few weeks ago. I had thought that this would be a good place to shock people right out of the gate in the opening contest, the opening segment of your show, and give Sammy the win. Because even people who may not be diehard AEW fans, who maybe are just casual fans, flip the show on, there's at least a chance they may have heard the name Cody Rhodes before. Or they may hear the name Rhodes and think, oh, that's Dusty Rhodes' son. There may be some familiarity with Cody, and he's all over the branding for the show. So it's not a leap, if you're not a huge fan, to watch the show and recognize that Cody is probably one of the featured stars in the show. So having somebody like Sammy get the shock win would be a memorable thing. And then what I proposed, why it made sense, I thought, would be Cody's already been announced as having a championship match with Chris Jericho November 9th at their Full Gear pay-per-view. But we also know that Chris Jericho is going to be defending the championship for the first time on television in a few weeks. He's going to have at least one title defense on TV before the match with Cody on the pay-per-view. So if Cody has his shot secure, then why not have Sammy get a win, even if it's just kind of a fluky win, but a win nonetheless, and give Sammy the first title shot against Jericho. Jericho would obviously win, but they could have a competitive match. It at least puts Sammy Guevara kind of on the map in a way, and up front and center early on here in his AEW run. I thought that that made a lot of sense. And we have found out since then that if Cody loses, he has said that he is out of his title match with Chris Jericho. And that's just not going to happen. So then I have to go with Cody. I'm making a prediction here on a winner. I have to go with Cody, if that's the stipulation. But then I wonder who Jericho defends against on October 16th in Philadelphia. I mean, I guess maybe whoever might interrupt him on the first show when he's in the ring cutting a promo. MJF takes on Brandon Cutler. MJF, the favorite son of the Dungeons & Dragons community. Hangman Adam Page takes on Pac. And yes, it is pronounced Pac. Excalibur was yelled at on Twitter a few weeks ago for calling him Pac. And he felt the need to respond. And he said that Pac himself told him that that is the correct way that the name is pronounced. So all you Pac people better get it out of your system. Or if you don't like hearing Pac, too bad. But this is the match that was supposed to have taken place on the Double or Nothing card back in May, and instead happened at a UK indie show, I think a week before, and it was put on YouTube. Adam Page is coming off a loss to Chris Jericho at All Out. Pac is coming off a win, a kind of surprising win, over Kenny Omega. I'm going to say Pac wins this. Riho and Nyla Rose will meet to crown the first ever AEW Women's Champion. Nyla had to apologize on social media for saying some stupid shit to a fan on Twitter. I don't think it affects the outcome of this match. I think Nyla Rose is going to be the first ever AEW Women's Champion. And Kenny Omega teams with the Young Bucks to take on AEW Champion Chris Jericho and two mystery partners. LAX would seem to make the most sense after the attack on the Bucks last month, but I mean, they would hardly be some big surprise since they've already debuted. I don't know who else it could be if not LAX. So I'm not even going to venture a guess. I don't know if it would be two single stars. I don't know if it's a new tag team they're bringing in, or it could just be Ortiz and Santana. We'll just have to wait and see. John Moxley is scheduled to appear on the show, and he is scheduled for a match in week two against Sean Spears in Boston. So I would certainly hope that his elbow is all healed up by now with that staph infection. So I'll be going live on YouTube after the show on Wednesday with my review. I'll be taking some phone calls at the very end as well. There was a lot of disappointment and even outrage this week when AEW announced its television deal for UK fans. And I myself heard from a lot of UK fans, I have a lot of UK listeners here, who were sounding off in their comments to me about how awful they thought this news was. We knew that there was a deal in place, a deal of some kind, with ITV to air the AEW show on ITV4, which may not have the kind of exposure that ITV proper has, but still, ITV, it's one of the biggest networks, family of networks in the UK. Being on any ITV station, my sense, is a big deal. Not just anybody can get on ITV. Well, that's not necessarily true. I got on ITV. It actually wasn't that hard. I've told that story before. They thought I was someone else. They had me on talking about the death of Burt Reynolds. And not only was I on ITV, I was on their morning show with Piers Morgan and everything. Apparently, it's like the biggest morning show in the UK. And I got on ITV before AEW ever did. So maybe it isn't so hard to get on ITV. But in any event, you know, the expectation was that the show would air live, which I guess would be at 1 o'clock in the morning over there. As it turns out, that is not the case. The show will be airing on ITV4, but the 4 stands for a 4-day delay, starting on Sunday, October 6th. So October 2nd is the AEW debut. This show will not air, this first show, until October 6th, and it will air at 8:20 in the morning, which is a very odd time to expect people to be up watching a wrestling show. And what that also means, being on that early in the morning over there, is that the show will probably wind up being very heavily edited for content at that hour. 8:20 in the morning is not exactly prime time. So they're also going to be airing a one-hour highlight show on ITV on Monday nights at 11:45 p.m. starting October 7th. Tony Khan, who I'm sure is just, you know, all week was just bombarded by angry tweets from UK fans, said that the episodes will stream live in the UK, but will be live on Fight TV for a price. So if you do want to watch the AEW show live, you will have the option to do so, but you will have to sign up on Fight TV for either $4.99 a month or $2.99 per episode. He says they cannot broadcast live, free to air, in the UK due to different ad break schedules than we have here in the US. Now, the reason WWE never had this issue is because they ran on Sky, or now, you know, BT Sport, which is not subject to the same regulations that a free-to-air station like ITV would be. Meltzer reports that the issue lies with TNT wanting a certain number of minutes of commercials each hour. In the UK, the maximum number of breaks that ITV is allowed is less than that. Whatever that number is, it is less than that. However, people have since highlighted this passage from the regulations over there that would exempt all live programming from such a rule. This is what the rule states. The following programs are exempt from Rule 16. Live events. These may take more breaks than are indicated. Live program feeds from an overseas broadcaster. These may take the break pattern of the originating broadcaster. There you go. So it sounds like that should not be an issue for them at all, if that is the case, if that is what's causing all the problems here. Tony Khan did say that, contrary to what people are speculating, that this is, you know, this would mean the go-home show to their pay-per-views like Full Gear in November would actually air after the pay-per-view itself. He said that is not the case. They will work with ITV to make sure that those shows air in advance of the pay-per-views, because that would make no sense, you know, for obvious reasons. So it will not be a case where Full Gear airs on November 9th, but the go-home show doesn't air until November 10th. That will not happen. I look at it like this, because again, I said there's a lot of anger and outrage over this whole situation. A lot of people feeling very let down. I look at it like this. AEW is an unproven commodity on television. They have never had their own weekly television show before. They've had a handful of big events. They've had a couple of streaming events. And that's it. They're an unproven commodity. A lot of wrestling shows get on smaller stations than ITV and they fail. So for them to even get on any of the ITV stations is an accomplishment in and of itself. But airing 4 days later at 8 o'clock in the morning is a big disappointment. I can understand why people would be upset. You know, I know Cody was on Twitter responding to people saying he thinks $5 a month, that's a hell of a deal. And I'm happy we were able to get the price down that low. But when he talks about their deal, as he has before, being so much better than the UK deal that WWE has. Yeah, and then later he says, well, it was part of a panel. We were just cracking jokes. So, well, that's not how people take these things. You know, and you're an executive vice president in this company. So people look to you as an authority that you're, you know, you're not just the performer. You're not just a wrestler. You know, you've got EVP in your title. People look to you for news and announcements because they're in the dark on what's going on. They're in the dark on the UK deal. They're in the dark on the Canada deal. The show's about to debut this week. People are looking for answers. You can't just turn around and say, well, I was joking or you know, anything like that. You go out and you say that we got a deal that's much better than the deal that WWE has. How can you not expect there to be backlash when people find out they have to pay to watch the show live? You know, maybe it's a case of too many cooks in the kitchen with all these executive VPs making comments. I don't know. But I would much rather under-promise and over-deliver than over-promise and under-deliver. And meanwhile, Meltzer says AEW is close to a deal with TSN to air the show live in Canada, but nothing is final yet. Cutting it awfully close. They are cutting it awfully close. Let's switch gears to Monday Night Raw. And not just the show from Monday, but there's a lot of news here as we head into the season premiere of Monday Night Raw. I don't think they said that enough times on Monday night. Help me out here. I'm confused. What kind of show is it tomorrow night? The what? The season what? I don't think I heard it enough times on Monday. Raw last week was from the Chase Center in San Francisco, California. California! Better get those Cali shows in before that new labor law takes effect. Before we get into what happened this week, we've got some news to tend to. As first reported weeks ago by WrestleVotes on Twitter, and since confirmed by WWE, your new announced team for Monday Night Raw, I believe effective tomorrow night, will be Vic Joseph and Dio Madden, who recently have been handling the announced duties with Aiden English on 205 Live. Dio is Brennan Williams. He has spent quite a while wrestling at the NXT Live events, played football before that, never did make his TV debut. He is now transitioned over to the announce role. The two of them will be joined at the booth by Jerry the King Lawler. Back on Monday Night Raw, Lawler told the Memphis Commercial Appeal that he got a call from WWE on Tuesday morning. He got a call from Kevin Dunn, who told him, I've got good news and I've got bad news. The bad news is that it requires Lawler to travel, which he hates doing. But the good news is that we want you back on Raw. And we want you back on Raw for however long you want to do it. So all these reports I see about how the Lawler move is only temporary, maybe that's how Vince McMahon and WWE are looking at it, but based on what Lawler said, he was told he's got the job as long as he wants it. So he said the original plan, and all the people, you know, I saw saying, well, WrestleVotes got it half right, because I think WrestleVotes is the source that originally said they were going back to two-man announce booths. And obviously now that's not, at least on Raw, that's not the case. But Lawler himself in the story admitted that the original plan was that they were going to go back to a two-man booth. But once Paul Heyman made the call, he wanted to, you know, Heyman was trying to think outside the box. It was Heyman's call to have Vic Joseph and Dio Madden on Monday Night Raw. And Lawler said that once that call was made to have Joseph and Dio on Raw, Vince McMahon turned around and said, well, you can't throw these two new young guys on our flagship show just like that. Call King. And that's when Lawler got the call from Kevin Dunn. So, I guess in a roundabout way, we have Paul Heyman to thank for inadvertently depriving us of a two-man announce booth, at least on Monday Night Raw. Yeah, I keep seeing, again, people saying that Lawler is just a temporary move, and Lawler is going to be in this role for as long as Lawler wants to be in this role for. Now, one interesting thing to note is that WWE had Mickie James doing commentary on Main Event last week with Vic Joseph and Dio Madden. Mickie has been out since having surgery in July to repair a torn ACL. And if she had ACL surgery in July, she's still a ways off from coming back, you know, if she comes back to the ring. But that could have been a trial run to see how she does. You know, maybe long term, the plan is to replace Renee Young as the female voice on Raw with another female voice. And maybe that female voice will end up being Mickie James if they feel she did well in the role. You know, I believe this may have been the first time that she's ever done commentary. I don't think you can just judge her based on one time. But that could be something to watch for going forward. Lawler, I can understand Vince McMahon's line of thinking that you've got two guys who are inexperienced being on the flagship show. And I question how much of a flagship Raw's going to be after this week once SmackDown goes to Fox. But Raw is their baby. Raw's the flagship. And in his mind, we've got these two guys. They're unproven. I'll go with Heyman. Heyman wanted them in the role. We'll go with them in the role. But, you know, he got what he wants. I want what I want. And what I want is Jerry Lawler in there because Lawler has been there, done that. Maybe Lawler can help, you know, guide them in some way. Give them advice. Look, I mean, Lawler's done this for many, many years. I don't doubt that he's got advice he could probably give to both these guys. But putting him back on Raw feels like a backwards move to me. There's nothing fresh and new about Jerry Lawler being back on Monday Night Raw. If that's what they're going for, that does not scream fresh and new to me. Now, over on SmackDown, the new team will be Michael Cole and Corey Graves, with Renee Young serving as the special contributor. We still don't know what that means exactly. All I know is that it gets Corey Graves on one show instead of two, and that is a positive. And if Renee Young is a special contributor who pops up every now and then, it does look like we have a two-man booth on SmackDown with Cole and Graves. And as far as Vic Joseph and Dio Madden, I hope people give them, you know, a little bit of time together before they start passing judgment. I, for one, am all for fresh faces on that show. Lawler move aside, there are fresh faces now on Raw. I think it's something that has been desperately needed, having those fresh voices. Now, what this means for Tom Phillips and Byron Saxton remains to be seen. Sean Ross Sapp of Fightful says that Phillips is going to be producing for WWE instead, which could mean any number of things. You know, I think Tom Phillips is actually a good play-by-play guy. I just don't know where you slot him now, other than 205 Live. There's now a spot open with Joseph and Madden being on Raw. They could put Phillips and Byron, if they wanted to, with Aiden English in the booth on 205 Live. That would be quite the demotion for Tom Phillips. And PW Insider reports that John Hennigan has signed a deal to return to WWE. The former John Morrison will be John Morrison once more. No more Johnny Mundo. No more Johnny Impact. His wife Taya is still staying with Impact. I was hoping personally for Johnny Elite. I think he would have made for a better addition to the AEW roster. It's like, you know, how long before he's doing parkour through the hallways chasing after the 24/7 title? Hennigan reacted to PW Insider's report on Twitter by not denying the story. He did not deny the report, but he sarcastically thanked PW Insider for the news, asking them to let him know when he is signed with AEW or ROH. You know, it's the old non-denial denial. See, it sounds to me like they didn't want the news getting out, and so he's doing what he can to act like it may not be true. You know, but Mike Johnson says he confirmed it, and he's more accurate than not. If it was false, Hennigan would have said so, and he didn't. So I do believe it's true, and I do believe that he is on his way back. And we have a draft coming up, right, in about a week or two. Maybe that's the place. I mean, we have the Raw season premiere tomorrow night. He could be there. But it might actually make more sense for him to just pop up as a surprise during the draft. Get a nice reaction, and then they, you know, put him on SmackDown or put him on Raw. The Raw Twitter poll for this past week, over 2,200 votes, 55% thumbs up, 45% thumbs down. This was a lame duck show, 1 week before the big season premiere that they would not shut up about for 3 hours. And 3 weeks, before the draft that may well shake up much of the roster anyway. Like I said, lame duck show. Truth be told, these season premiere teases that, you know, I was just kind of joking and complaining about, and a lot of other people were complaining about, these are nothing new from Monday Night Raw. This is not a product of the new era of Monday Night Raw. They go back all the way to the mid-90s. Now, they may have stopped doing them for a while, like during the Attitude Era, but I know I'm not making this up in my mind. I can remember them teasing the season premiere of Monday Night Raw as far back as 94 or 95. It's probably a USA Network thing. I know it sounds stupid because this is not a show that has seasons. It's a year-round show, so how do you have a season premiere? I'm sure it's a network thing. Two good things coming from this season premiere tomorrow night, per the New York Post, quoting Kevin Dunn himself. New sets for both Raw and SmackDown. New logos, which we have already seen. New graphics. New theme songs for both shows. Legendary by Skillet is the new song for Raw. And Are You Ready by AC/DC is the new song for SmackDown. And also, not to be forgotten in all this, the return of Pyro. Pyro is returning, including, according to Kevin Dunn, flames and lasers. You know, if we can get holograms, they could just put the old guys on TV every week and not even use the current roster, instead of just trotting them out every now and then to try to boost ratings. We had another good match between King Corbin and Chad Gable. Not as good as their King of the Ring match, but it is fun to watch Chad Gable come out to no reaction. Well, I mean, that's not fun, but to watch him come out to no reaction, but by the end of the match, he has got these people hanging on to every near fall. And credit to Corbin for playing his role well. Gable, though, has the ability to get the people behind him. That's what I believe, just as an observer, what he has proven, what he has shown these last few weeks is that he has the ability to get the people behind him, to get the people invested, which is a very powerful thing to have. It would be nice if they continued to do something with that once this feud has run its course. Lacey Evans beat Ember Moon. Not a good spot for Ember to be in, losing on SmackDown, so let's go to Raw and lose there too. Lacey won with the sharpshooter, but when she went to go lean back on the sharpshooter, she sort of fell over. Still better than The Rock's sharpshooter. Her sharpshooter may need some work, but her social media game, I have to say, is on point. Unfortunately, we live in a world where everyone is offended by everything at all times. And every little action requires an apology or an explanation. Lacey filmed a video of her being pulled over during a traffic stop, traveling through Canada, and insulting the police officer when he gave her a speeding ticket. It was very clear, to wrestling fans anyway, it was very clear that she was in character. She used her character name in the skit. But some people were complaining about how offended they were. How could she disrespect an officer of the law like that? And then media outlets picked it up as an actual news story. Both parties then had to issue statements. It's like some kind of international incident here. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police put a statement out saying the female motorist was stopped for a speeding infraction where a provincial offense notice was issued. The female motorist then engaged in a courteous and polite conversation with the member where the motorist identified herself as a sports entertainer with World Wrestling Entertainment. She asked the member if he would participate in a rehearsed interaction on camera with her WWE persona. The member obliged. Lacey then broke kayfabe and said, as prior law enforcement myself and a United States Marine, I do not condone, agree with, or promote disrespecting or making law enforcement officers' jobs harder than they already are. The video was created by both parties to promote the local live event taking place in the Edmonton area. As a sports entertainer, it is my job to not only entertain, but also set the proper example. So with that being said, I'm glad all of you were entertained, but if you ever try to honestly disrespect or put my brothers and sisters in blue in harm, I hope you get what you ask for. I hate this. I hate this. I hate that she even felt the need to have to explain herself. I hate that. Rey Mysterio won a fatal five-way elimination match over Ricochet, AJ Styles, Shinsuke Nakamura, and Bobby Roode to earn a Universal Championship match with Seth Rollins on Raw tomorrow night. I said it at the top of the show, I could not have timed this any better if I tried, with the end of my Mysterio countdown coming up later on here in the podcast. You guys know that I have been advocating for a Rey Mysterio versus Ricochet match in WWE. We got one in Lucha Underground, and I want to see one now in WWE before Rey hangs it up for good. We got a small taste of that here in this match, but their interaction was very limited. Ricochet was out first at the hands of Nakamura. Styles then eliminated Nakamura. They have a little bit of a history together. Shockingly, they were in the ring together, and AJ did not get kicked in the balls or low-blowed. Shocking. Bobby Roode eliminated AJ Styles. We got some mild TNA chance when the two of them were in the ring working together. And Rey eliminated Roode to win the match. Very good match. Very good match. Maybe Rey can win the title in hour one this week, and then John Cena can beat him for it at the end of the show. Sensitive Seth Rollins against Braun Strowman ended with a DQ win for Braun when he was attacked by the Fiend with the mandible claw. The sight of Seth Rollins cowering in the corner, crying like a man-child, may have been the most embarrassing thing that I have seen all year. And I am not saying, I am a big fan of The Fiend, you guys know. I am not saying that he should laugh it off. He should no-sell The Fiend. Like Steve-O on Raw with Umaga that time to kind of shake it off. I'm not saying he should do that. But if ever there was a reaction that screamed, I am not a top guy and I am not a world champion, it is the reaction that we saw from Seth Rollins on Monday night. And to give you an example, I was talking about that little mini documentary earlier on the network, the debut of Kane, okay? I'll use him as an example. When Kane first debuted, he was booked like a scary monster, just like The Fiend. He even set people on fire. Undertaker and others were able to sell it without crying on television. Rollins is like, you know, he's like the female in every 70s and 80s slasher flick, who cries and screams at the sight of the evil bad guy, except Sigourney Weaver, an alien, because she was a badass. You know, maybe he ought to let his fiance wrestle The Fiend instead. She'd be a lot braver than he is. Tomorrow night, Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair have been announced for Miz TV. Seems ripe for an appearance by The Fiend, but then again, so does the main event. Or what? I shouldn't even say that Rollins and Rey is the main event. They may open the show with them, for all I know. But if The Fiend can only appear once on this show, it's probably more likely to be at the end of the Rollins-Rey Mysterio match. It is also notable that when The Miz mentioned Hulk Hogan's name on TV, the live crowd booed. But hey, maybe he'll come out and he'll promote the Riyadh season tomorrow night. Rollins defends the Tomato title against Rey Mysterio. You know, we have not heard anything new in weeks about Finn Balor. He got married recently, which I imagine is why he asked for some time off. He was said to be due back in October. And guess what this week is? It's October. So I wonder if we might get a rematch, after all, between Balor and the Demon, or the Fiend, at Survivor Series. Only it's Demon Balor this time against the Fiend. And the Demon maybe appears next Sunday at Hell in a Cell. And that's how they get out of having to put the championship on Bray without just beating him straight up. Maybe the Demon is their way out. Also official for tomorrow night is AJ Styles defending the United States Championship against Cedric Alexander. I thought he was being buried. Wasn't that the report? I thought Cedric was being buried. How come he's getting a U.S. title match? Oh, man. I had people email me. They go, you know, when I talked about this last week and I said, don't believe everything that you read and there's no evidence that Cedric is being buried. And I did not know where this report originated from. And people said, well, it came from Meltzer. And you quote Meltzer all the time. So are you saying that he's a liar? No, what I'm saying is that I'm a human being and he's a human being. We're not robots and nothing is absolute. a lot of the stuff that Meltzer reports, there is truth to it, or it does bear fruit. Some of it doesn't. That doesn't mean he's making it up or lying, but that particular report never passed the smell test to me, so whoever was feeding him that information, I didn't believe it. And I still don't believe it. I still see no evidence that Cedric Alexander is being buried. Now, if he gets beaten 2 minutes this week, and then we don't see him on television after that for a while, then maybe there's truth to the story. All I'm saying is I don't buy into it. That doesn't mean that automatically, discolors everything that this person reports. It just means that I'm not a machine, I'm not a robot, and I don't have to believe every single thing that the man says. And nor should you. You should never believe everything that a person says just because, well, they report this and this was true, so then this must be true. Well, that's not always the case. This story just never really passed the smell test to me. I don't believe that Cedric Alexander is being buried. Time will bear out whether that's true or not. How can you make that determination because of 1 week? It just doesn't make any sense. Anyway, he's getting a U.S. title match now. And Sasha Banks will go one-on-one against Alexa Bliss. And as you might expect, it has been a week of sniping between the Bliss bots and the Sasha stans. Oh, I cringe even saying that word, but I guess that's what they're called, right? The Sasha stans. Reason being, these two have had heat with each other for years. Unless they're playing it up as one big work, I get the sense that Sasha and Alexa, they don't like each other very much. They don't socialize a whole lot together. And after that kick that Sasha gave Alexa during their tag team match a few weeks ago, where Alexa was on the apron and Sasha just went over and kicked her hard in the midsection, Alexa didn't seem too happy about it. That set people off on social media. They thought that's a shoot kick. She's being unprofessional. She's being disrespectful. What is she doing? She could have hurt her. She could have broken her ribs. Oh my God. After that kick, people lost their minds. Alexa fans lost their minds. I mean, they thought that this was tantamount to Pearl Harbor. It was an act of war. So the resulting tweets this week, once this match was announced, were about as bad as you would expect. You can tell them apart because they either have Alexa's face or Sasha's face as their avatars. But I thought that I would just take a selection of tweets here. And I don't want to paint them all with a broad brush. There were some tweets saying, man, this is going to be a great match. Man, I can't wait to see this match. Go Alexa. Go Sasha. There actually are a lot of very tolerant, smart, sensible people who just so happen to be fans of Sasha Banks and who just so happen to be fans of Alexa Bliss. But the extreme ends of their fan bases have built up quite the reputation on Twitter. And this is why. This is a sampling of why. Steven WWE Fan 98 Fan Account. That's a mouthful. He is clearly in the Sasha camp. Can't wait for Sasha to tap out this fake blonde woman trying to play pro wrestler next week. Alexa stans baby her too damn much because they know she is this a terrible character and pro wrestler. Hashtag the blueprint. Hashtag the standard. Sasha owns Alexa. Don't at me. Alexa Bliss stans. You know, I have to think that in today's day and age of hashtags and all the vernacular that you would see on social media, I would hate to be an English teacher. We might even have some English teachers listening to this right now. I wonder if these people have any hair left on their heads from yanking them out of the roots when they hear things like this. When they hear people talking like this. I mean, this is not, we're not talking like text messaging, OMG, LOL, like, Some of these phrases and these words, it just blows my mind. The English, I weep for the English language. Mike Levy, this is a horrible idea. I legit fear for Alexa Bliss's safety. Sasha proved last week that she has no qualms about taking cheap shots for real. How can she be trusted to protect her opponent when she does shit like that? So Mike thinks that Alexa's life could potentially be in jeopardy here. He's very concerned about her well-being. Alexa Bliss Guy, I'm sure he'll be impartial with a name like that, he says, They show Alexa no respect, so I'm damn sure coming for them if that's the game they want to play. Go tell you Sasha stands to be more respectful and at least admit that Alexa is over and a star, which most would not even admit. Bubba says, I stan both of them and do so proudly. There's no need to pick a side, just enjoy the two greatest of all time. You know, Bubba had me there up until that last part. I had quite the laugh. Quite the laugh. I mean, who knows? 10 years from now, Sasha's going into the Hall of Fame. Maybe some people will look back on Sasha as the greatest of all time. They may look back at Charlotte or Becky as the greatest of all time. Alexa, I'm not so sure about that, but to call them the greatest of all time here today in 2019 is quite the statement to make. Blissfully Stratified says, no matter how many Kool-Aid wigs Sasha Smurf wears. I did, you know what, I pulled that one. I have to say, I have to admit that I did laugh. That's why I pulled this one. When I read Sasha Smurf, I did lose my shit there for a little bit. So I will give a hat tip here to Blissfully Stratified. No matter how many Kool-Aid wigs Sasha Smurf wears, she will never be able to step to the goddess Alexa Bliss. And finally, the soup du jour of tweets. If you were to spit, piss, and vomit in said soup. This is from someone whose name and handle I will not share because she appears to be psychotic. We'll just call her Cray, last initial Z. She is a diehard Sasha Banks supporter. Apparently her account has been suspended before, I can't imagine why, with tweets like this. Alexa, suck. That bitch needs to have another eating disorder and die. And don't worry, Sasha, and she tags Sasha in this. I will drag that bitch for you, and you love to see it. I would much rather see Crazy and Alexa Bliss guy go at it tomorrow night on TV. Maybe the ring would implode and the earth would just swallow them whole. I've heard about, you know, the Bella Army before, but the Bliss bots and the Sasha stands, this is like nothing I've ever seen before. And any one of those tweets could win for sad tweet of the week. But I'm going to go with this exchange here between Kalisto and Charlotte Flair. And some of the responses that followed. Kalisto was responding to something that Andrade had to say. The last I even thought of Kalisto was when he teased that his contract was running out. He was teasing that his contract was running out and that he might leave. And Braun Strowman responded with adios, or it was like hashtag adios. After this, between that and this exchange here, I think Kalisto may want to step away from Twitter for a while. But he told Andrade, and I had to translate it here, but he told Andrade, you only have a job because you're with a Flair. He's obviously trying to get a little feud going here on social media with the hope that it might translate into something on TV. What he probably did not bank on was that Andrade's girlfriend would respond in kind. This is what Charlotte had to say. It's not because of me. It's because he's pretty. They keep a mask on you for a reason. Ouch. Poor Kalisto. This guy can't catch a break. But the Twitter insanity does not end there. The first reply, sometimes I look at this and I say to myself, this show would be like 90 minutes long if it wasn't for Twitter. I get some great material from Twitter. Scary. Scary. But I get some of my best material comes from Twitter. The first reply to Charlotte's post is from an older gentleman who appears to have a very unhealthy obsession with Miss Charlotte. It's scary. He says, he's not your man, in response to, I guess, Charlotte talking about Andrade. He's not your man. Look, I don't know why you won't chat with me, but go ahead when he leaves you, and maybe you should come find me, the actual only person that loves you for the true person that you are. It's you that I love and deeply care for. Not because of your fame, but because of the real person that you are. I had to go to this guy's page, and it is unbelievably creepy. I don't envy what these women have to go through on social media. It is positively disturbing. Now, maybe the guy is just lonely. Maybe he doesn't know how to talk to women. Maybe he's very inexperienced. But it's the constant tweets that I see on this guy's timeline and the flashes of anger. It's scary. It's very scary.
We use the word revolution because this is a revolution!
Wednesday, October 2nd will be a night to remember for wrestling fans with the debut of All Elite Wrestling on TNT.
We're going to change the world of professional wrestling as you know it.
Made for wrestling fans by the wrestlers themselves, AEW flies higher.
Takes to the skies!
Hits harder.
Oh, gosh!
Oh, my God, brother!
And pulls no punches. With a roster including AEW champion Chris Jericho.
A little bit of the bubbly.
The Young Bucks, Jon Moxley.
This is what you call a paradigm shift.
Cody and Brandi Rhodes, the Lucha Bros, Nyla Rose, Britt Baker, and more.
How do you like AEW now?
A new league rises. All Elite Wrestling Dynamite, Wednesday, October 2nd at 8, 7 Central on TNT. The final SmackDown Live on USA was also at the Chase Center in San Francisco. Twitter poll, over 1,400 votes, 55% thumbs up, 45% thumbs down. Identical to the results of this week's Raw poll. I don't remember the last time that has happened, where the results on Monday were identical to the results on Tuesday. And a 55-45 split, that ain't good. In a dark match before they went live on Tuesday, Apollo Crews beat Buddy Murphy. I had completely forgotten about Murphy after that string of good matches that he had on TV, which included Daniel Bryan putting him over, only for him to vanish into thin air. Good to see they didn't squander that win over the former WWE champion. I guess the story must be true, that his push really was all just an accident, because he was in the right place at the right time during that forklift segment with Roman Reigns. Back to the scrap heap with him. The draft is coming up. It'd be a good chance for them to make things right and do something with Buddy Murphy. I hope they do. Another guy Daniel Bryan has been working very hard to put over is Eric Rowan. We heard from him at the top of the show, and then he not only wrestled Bryan, he beat him with the claw slam thanks to some help from Luke Harper. Almost 20 minutes they gave these two. If they're gonna win myself and others over, who still aren't totally sold on Eric Rowan in this role, this is the way to do it. You know, you give him some mic time, give him some big wins. The match itself, I thought, was good. Roman Reigns made the save for Bryan after the match, and this now leads to Daniel Bryan and Roman Reigns as tag team partners at Hell in a Cell against Luke Harper and Eric Rowan. And after all of this, after what we saw here on this show, Bryan, a long, competitive 20-minute match with Eric Rowan, and being beaten up by Rowan and beaten up by Harper. After all of this, I suppose now at this point, it really does not make a whole lot of sense if Bryan just turns around and reveals himself to be the mastermind behind the plot to kill Roman, and he's been in cahoots the whole time with Rowan and Harper, because I thought that's where they were going with this. And if they are, they're doing a hell of a job to prove to people that that's not what they're planning, and at this point, it wouldn't even make any sense for him to turn around and reveal that, because what would be the point? You know, at this point, it's almost like it actually would make sense for WWE to do it, because now they've put themselves in a situation where this wouldn't make any sense. That's never stopped them before. That doesn't mean, though, that Bryan can't still turn on Roman. Maybe he doesn't go with Harper and Rowan, but he could still turn on Roman and the two of them could still be in for a feud. I still feel like that's probably where we're headed. I thought Carmella looked good in the ring, teaming with Charlotte against Sasha and Bayley. She took the loss to the bank statement, and she's still doing the 24/7 silliness. She is the 24/7 champion, unless she lost it this morning, and I haven't heard yet. Maybe she got attacked and rolled up at the airport. Who the fuck knows? The title debuted in May. She's already the 54th 24/7 champion. If they want her to be taken seriously again as a contender for the women's title, they have to break her away from this 24/7 stuff. You know, when the Brigade of Nimrods came out to chase, this time it was the women. right? I mean, if the men are going to be booked like fools, why can't the women be booked like fools? Equal opportunity. So this whole horde of women, this whole horde of Nimrods comes running down to the ring to chase after Truth and Carmella, chasing after the 24/7 championship, and it pains me to call them a brigade of Nimrods, and among the Nimrods were Asuka and Kairi Sane. And I was filled with sadness. Not even anger. I wasn't even angry. I was filled with sadness that this is the best that they could come up with for either of these women on this show. And I know they got a win later in the show. They beat Mandy and Sonya. I don't even care. I don't care. That does not make up for it. This was a low point in the careers of Asuka and Kairi Sane. At this point, Asuka would be better off becoming a full-time gamer. I've been following her YouTube channel. She's been doing these gaming videos. She is so likable. These videos are so cool to watch. I'd almost rather she just go full-time into that at this point, if this is what they're going to do with her. You know, one of the mailbag questions I got this week, I bumped it up here because I may as well just cover it now, from Dre the Franchise. Shout out to Dre. He knows how big a fan I was of Lucha Underground. He pointed out that WWE now has two of the three members of the Lotus Tribe under contract, in Kairi Sane and Io Shirai. Do I think it would be a good idea for WWE to create its own version of a triad faction by putting them with Asuka and possibly going for both the women's tag titles and one of the women's championships? Dre, let me put it to you like this. On TV this week, they had Asuka and Kairi Sane running through the arena chasing after the 24/7 title. Right down to Kairi looking through her pirate spyglass as she was running, like she was searching for buried treasure. Before this week, I couldn't tell you the last time she was even on TV. She has been buried with her treasure. I was not a fan of them pairing the two off to begin with because it just felt like, well, we don't know what to do with Asuka. So we'll pair her off with the other Japanese lady. And then we'll put the British lady with them because they can't speak good English. Having now seen what they've done with these two, I say go for it. As great as Io has been on NXT, she is dead in the water the moment that she shows up on Raw or SmackDown. And now we're heading into this period where the shows are getting a makeover. We're going to find out how serious they are about Heyman's influence on Raw, Bischoff's influence on SmackDown. Maybe things will be different. I've heard this for years. Oh, things are going to be different. Things are going to be different. They're never different. They're never different. Nothing ever changes. So I have no reason to believe that when the day comes that Io Shirai is moved over to Raw or moved over to SmackDown, other than maybe her first night, that things are going to be any different, because look at what they have done with some of the other Asian and Japanese stars and women that they have brought up to the main roster, the ones that don't speak great English. Look at where they have ended up. Look at where we are. Why would Io Shirai be treated any differently? Why? Because she's one of the best women's wrestlers in the world? That's what people said about Asuka. Didn't help her. I look at this and Dre's idea, and I say, go for it. Put her in a team with Kairi, preferably as heels. Have Asuka chase after one of the women's championships. Have them chase after the women's tag team titles. And put a stranglehold on those. Sounds like a good plan to me. Anything would be better than them chasing after the green belt like some kind of opening card act. The big main event of this show was one of my favorite kinds of segments. I love these segments. A segment where one guy brings a bunch of lawyers out to the ring with him. I agree with some of you who tweeted me, at least make it interesting and send, and I can't believe they didn't think to do this, send Joseph Park Esquire out to the ring. I mean, you've got the guy in the back. He works for you. In fact, he probably has ownership over the gimmick. You know, when Impact started letting people take their gimmick names with them, like EC3 and everything, which was a cool policy for them to put in place, if they really wanted him to be Joe Park Esquire, he probably could use the same gimmick right down to the name if they really wanted to. How hard would it be to send him out there as Shane's lawyer? Hell, he could be Shane's bodyguard. He's a big dude. Is Abyss. That at least would have been cool. This was decisively not cool. Shane threatens to drag this out and keep Kevin Owens tied up in court for years, or as the McMahon family calls it, the CM Punk. Or Owens can drop his lawsuit and be reinstated immediately, and out of the goodness of his heart, because of the humanitarian that he is, Shane McMahon will drop the $100,000 fine. Pump the brakes for a second. Reinstated? He never missed a week! He never missed a week of television. Oh, well, he can't wrestle. Who cares? He never missed a single week of television. Not only was he in the crowd having bought a ticket the week after he was supposedly fired, he invited him into the ring. He was in the ring. He never missed a week. And they're talking about reinstatement. You know, when Randy Savage retired in 91, he lost to the Ultimate Warrior, a career-ending match. Of course, his career didn't end. But at least he was out of the ring and in the booth and not allowed to wrestle for however many months it was. And to bring him back, they built up this like fan campaign trying to get the fans to tell Jack Tunney, we want the Macho Man to be reinstated, because he was gone for a while. He was gone for many months. And by that point, people were dying to see him get back into the ring. Where's the buildup here? Why am I supposed to care? I might reinstate you if you do this. We never missed him. He never left. You at least had the chance, if you wanted to, 1 week on the show last week, have him pop up at Full Sail NXT, shaking hands with Triple H. Shane gets jealous. They could have at least done that. They didn't even do that. He just showed up on SmackDown the week after. Reinstated. And I'm supposed to give a shit. Owen says, it's not about the money, it's about getting rid of Shane. He proposed a ladder match with legal documents hanging above the ring. I can't think of anything better that I would put my body on the line for in a ladder match than a bunch of legal documents. The only thing closer would be a briefcase full of tax returns. If Shane wins, Owens drops his lawsuit and he remains fired. If Owens wins, then Shane is gone. They were in such a crunch for time here at the end of this segment to go off the air, because they have these hard stops now on USA. No matter what, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, you're off the air. No more overruns. And Fox is not going to be any different, because at 10 p.m. in a lot of markets, like here in New York, you've got the 10 o'clock news. So, I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to treat this like a sport every single week? The show's going to go off the air at 10:03, 10:05? Bullshit. They're going to have the same hard stop they had on USA. Maybe on week one, they give them some leeway. And they go over by a few minutes. But I can't see that becoming a regular occurrence, so it's not going to be any different now on Fox. They've got that hard stop. They were running low on time. They cut their mics before they were even done speaking. I'm like watching. I see Shane and Owens in the ring out of the corner of my eye. And I could see them, and they're talking, but I don't hear anything. I thought there was something wrong with my TV. Then they quickly cut backstage. And we see Sasha Banks beating up Becky Lynch and leaving her lane. And so the final scene of the final SmackDown, possibly ever, on USA, is of Becky Lynch laying on the ground moaning. It's not quite silk stockings, but it's close. This Friday is the big debut on Fox. They've got Progressive Insurance on board as the presenting sponsor of the show, which will now revert back to its old name of Friday Night SmackDown. And according to an article in Ad Age, as a way to entice more younger viewers to watch the show, they are considering cutting the number of ad spots by as much as 20%. And there will be no more double box commercials like they were doing on USA, where they keep the live action on screen in a tiny box while the ads play on the other side of the screen. No more of that. Shane McMahon will wrestle Kevin Owens in a ladder match. That is happening on Friday. It is not Hell in a Cell. It is happening on Friday night. Also announced, Charlotte and Becky Lynch team up, as they did at Madison Square Garden a few weeks ago, against Sasha Banks and Bayley. Brock Lesnar challenges Kofi Kingston for the WWE Championship. I not only would not be surprised to see Kofi retain his title here, I'm going to pick Kofi to retain. I'm predicting that Kofi Kingston is going to retain the WWE Championship here on this show. I am going to take the underdog on this one. I do think in the end he'll be beaten, Maybe it happens 2 days later at Hell in a Cell. I don't know if it's New Day coming out to help him, or somebody else maybe comes out to cost Brock Lesnar the match, and that's Brock's next big feud. I just feel like it's so predictable and so obvious that Kofi is going to get murdered here in this match. It might be a little more competitive than their last match was, 4 years ago in Japan. But it just seems so patently obvious that people are already talking about Kofi like, well, he had a good run. Or some people say, no, he didn't really have a good run. I still think he's a mid-card guy. Everyone's been talking about Kofi Kingston like the guy is dead. They're eulogizing him already. I think they're putting the cart before the horse here. I think Kofi's going to find a way to retain, maybe not win the match. Maybe it's some kind of a no contest or a DQ. But I am not convinced that he is losing this championship on Friday. And in fact, I think he'll leave SmackDown with it. And they will also be celebrating 20 years of SmackDown with an appearance by Stone Cold Steve Austin, Hulk Hogan, and Ric Flair, who are already appearing on Raw Monday night. We've got Sting, we've got Goldberg, Kurt Angle, Mick Foley, Booker T, Lita, Mark Henry, and might we see a surprise cameo from The Rock? It would only be right for him to be there, given how the show was named after him. So I think it's possible we see The Rock, and if we do, hopefully we see him in the flesh, and it's not just some kind of little video message. On Stone Cold, let me mention this real quick, because a bunch of websites, including some really shitty websites, but even some websites that I like, they ran with a quote from his most recent podcast, where he talked about the match with WrestleMania 19 against The Rock. And it was actually very fascinating to hear him go back, and he remembers thinking the match was the shits, and now he went back and watched it, and he thought it was a really good match. I also thought that it was the weakest of the three matches they had at WrestleMania, but with the benefit of hindsight, if I were to go back and watch it again, maybe my opinion would change. I actually liked the match at 15. So, me personally, I'd probably go 17, 15, 19, but I'd have to go back and watch it again like Austin did. But anyway, he was dissecting the match and breaking the match down and kind of, giving us some insight about what was going on in his mind at the time. And in the course of doing the show, towards the end, in the final few minutes of the show, he said that physically, could he come back today and have one more match? Because he gets asked all the time. And I was backstage at Raw Reunion, and I was here and there in Madison Square Garden, and I'm getting all these comments from people and some of the other WWE superstars. Hey, you look great. You're in great shape. You think you got one more match left in you? And he said, physically, could I have one more match if I wanted to? Absolutely. I think I can not only have one more match, I can have one more match and not get hurt and not get injured. He has said this for years. This is not news. The part that they left out of most of these articles, headlined by Stone Cold might, will Stone Cold have one more match? Stone Cold says he might have another match. The part that they left out, because I guess it doesn't make for as good of a headline, is that Austin said immediately after that, but no, I'm done. It's going to be 17 years since he had his last match. If he was going to come back, he would have come back by now. He would have come back for a match with CM Punk after they did that sit-down interview with Jim Ross to promote the video game. What was that, 2013? Or 2012, maybe going into 2013? If he was ever going to come back, that was the time to do it. That was the right opponent at the right time. The fact that he didn't, and I think he may have actually had knee surgery at the time, so maybe physically he couldn't have anyway, but the fact that he didn't, and never really seemed to take the idea of coming back seriously for a match around that time, tells you all you need to know about whether or not he'll ever come back for another match. He didn't, because he is done. And he said as much on the podcast. You would never know it reading the articles on some of these websites, though. 17 years. Let it go. He is not coming back. He is not going to Saudi Arabia. If he needed the money, he would have come back by now. This is a non-story.
Let me remind you, and I think a lot of people here will agree, NXT is way better than the WWE.
NXT Week 2 from Full Sail University on USA. Ratings were down. Still over a million viewers, though. That may change if they split part of the audience when AEW debuts this Wednesday. The question is, will they cannibalize each other, or will it lead to a combined audience of, let's say, 2 million people? That would be incredible for AEW if it did. I'll take a guess and say that we're looking at around 1.3 or 1.4 million combined. So it takes a small chunk out of the NXT audience, but NXT still wins decisively. So, what do you think my favorite match was from this week's show? If you said anything other than Keith Lee against Dominik Dijakovic, you think you know me, but you have no idea. That said, I have to say this. As much as I really liked this match, and I can watch these two, you know, have a whole series of matches and never get tired of it, I hated that top rope Canadian Destroyer being used for a near fall. Hated it. I criticized when they would do it in Lucha Underground and NXT, or even in AEW, and NXT is not immune to that same criticism. Certain moves just should not be used for anything other than a finish. That should be one of them, especially when the guy taking the move is over 300 pounds and he gets spiked right on top of his head. But I still like the match. Keith Lee evened things up at one win apiece with the jackhammer. 1-1-1, I guess, if you count the double countout from a few months ago. This was the perfect way, I thought, to open the show. Also, the second week in a row, in my opinion, that they opened with the best match on the entire show. Dakota Kai is back. She beat Tainara Conchi, who's now just going by Tainara. Matt Riddle tapped out Killian Dane with a Fujiwara armbar in a 20-minute street fight. I thought this probably went a little too long. It dragged for me at times. They brawled all over Full Sail and into the bleachers, which is the first time I can remember anyone actually fighting into the bleachers and having them clear the bleachers. Adam Cole came out after the match to talk shit to Riddle. Riddle trapped him in the armbar until Undisputed Era ran out and Riddle bailed. Matt Riddle will now challenge Adam Cole for the NXT Championship this Wednesday. He's not winning it, but that's going to be a fun match. Rhea Ripley, in hour two, when they migrated over to the network, I didn't hear really any complaints this week about the migration over to the network, whereas before, myself and a lot of people couldn't even log on. And now this was the last week that they even had to worry about this, but it sounds like whatever that issue was, they fixed it. Rhea Ripley beat Lacey Lane, who is now going by the name Caden Carter. Lacey Lane is a much better name. Lacey got more offense in than I thought she would, but this was meant to be a showcase for Rhea. Riptide for the win. Total star. That's all I could think when this woman walks out. Total star. The new team of Ever Rise, Chase Parker and Matt Martell. I saw Kevin Owens wearing a Parker and Martell shirt on his Twitter page, so obviously he's a big fan of these two guys. I believe these two are fellow Canadians, which may be why Owens was wearing their shirt. They lost to Danny Burch and Oney Lorcan. Another showcase for the new guys, but here they fell short. I'm not sure if they have real plans for Parker and Martell. Before it just felt like they were being used as enhancement guys. This week felt different. They gave them a lot of offense. It felt like they may actually have plans for these two to become a bigger part of the tag team division. Burch did this new thing where he fires up in the ring, he yells out Oney's name, and Lorcan, who happened to be on the outside on the floor, he hears this and he goes nuts, like a wild man, and he tags himself into the match and he wins the match. We'll see if it catches on. Cameron Grimes beat Raul Mendoza, second week in a row. Last time he beat him quickly with the leaping foot stomp. This time it was more of a showcase for Mendoza. Mendoza's really good, and Grimes, he won again. Grimes does nothing for me. I'm sure he's a very good wrestler. He does nothing for me. Maybe I just need to see more of him. But what I saw of him in Impact, you know, again, good wrestler, but there's just nothing there to really get excited about. I was more excited to see Mendoza doing his thing here in this match than I was Cameron Grimes. Kushida was teasing two mystery partners against Fabian Aichner, Marcel Bartel, and Alexander Wolfe of Imperium. When the sirens played for the mystery partners to come out, I thought for a second that he had recruited Scott Steiner to be one of his partners. Kushida and Scott Steiner. What a tag team that would be. Almost like the tag team of Brock Lesnar and Tajiri. I'm going to mention them a little bit later on in the podcast. It would be easier to understand Kushida than it would be to probably understand a Scott Steiner promo. I have to say that. Instead, though, we didn't get Scott Steiner. We got Breezango, which was quite the letdown as far as mystery partners go. Kushida cradled Bartel for the win. Walter jumped him on stage and Imperium stood tall to end the show. It has been all wrestling so far on these first two USA shows. No promo work at all. I understand why. They want to go balls to the wall on the action. But it is very odd to switch networks and expose the product to a new audience without doing a better job of introducing people to who some of these people are. Or, you know, giving mic time to some of the new guys. Long term, this show cannot just be match after match after match. You know, even the people who want to see more wrestling on the TV shows, like Raw and SmackDown, and maybe they'll complain when SmackDown on a two-hour show only has, you know, 20 minutes of wrestling. I admit the same thing. You have to have more than 20 minutes of wrestling on a two-hour show. But I don't think any of these people, and I know myself, I've never advocated for an all-wrestling show. You've got to have more than just wrestling. But whatever you're going to give, if it's a skit of some kind, if it's a promo interview, something like that. And you know, we don't need 20-minute promos either. But you've got to have a balance. You've got to have a mix of those things. And NXT right now, so far, has just been all action. I just don't think they can sustain that, you know, long term. But this Wednesday, let the battle begin. They have added a pre-show on the network and YouTube at 7:30, just like they would for a takeover show. And they are promoting limited commercial interruption for this week's NXT on USA. This will be the first live NXT to air both hours on USA Network. Johnny Gargano takes on Shane Thorne. The Street Profits will challenge Fish and O'Reilly for the NXT Tag Team title. Shayna Baszler defends the NXT Women's Championship against Candice LeRae. And Adam Cole defends the NXT title against Matt Riddle. I don't think Undisputed Era is losing any of the gold that it has. So I think Fish and O'Reilly retain. Riddle may win the match, but I don't think he's winning the championship, not yet. Which means the one title that I believe is in the most jeopardy of changing hands on Wednesday is the women's. And I'll make a prediction now and say that Candice LeRae wins the championship and then transitions into a feud or continues her feud with Io Shirai over the championship. And I can see Io, maybe even in her first title defense, taking the championship away from Candice. And we end up with heel Io as the champion. Now, if I'm Io, put your kayfabe cap on here. If you're Io Shirai, why interfere and cost, you know, Candice the match when you've been feuding with her? You can just let her win the championship and have her be the one that you beat to become the champion. So that's my, you know, when I'm thinking about how this match could go, you could have Io interfere and cost Candice the match, or just let them have a great match. And Candice could be that underdog, that scrappy underdog who somehow finds a way to, you know, slip out of the choke, pull out the win. But then she's got to contend with Io going forward. And what that means for Shayna is, you know, I could see Shayna shifting over to Raw or SmackDown in the draft. I just think the timing of it is perfect. You know, Shayna has had a great run as the champion in NXT. And she's a two-time, I think maybe the first ever two-time NXT Women's Champion. She's got this big title defense coming up against Candice. They're going to be live on USA against AEW head-to-head for the first time. I don't think any of the other titles are changing hands, but I could see them wanting to have a title change. And a week later, you have this draft. It just seems the right time to make that move. I'm going to pick Candice. I'm also going to pick Gargano over Thorne. And obviously the other matches, you already know my pick, they're going to retain their title. So that's the way the NXT show is looking on Wednesday. Going to be a lot of fun. Head to head, get ready. For this week's RSPW Rewind, I thought we would go back in the Wayback Machine after a very insightful look back, I thought, last week about the debut of Goldust, some divided opinion about the character and his debut, his arrival on television in WWE. I thought we would go back and see what people were saying about the Heartbreak Kid, Shawn Michaels, a very polarizing figure in the RSPW universe, from what I can see. First, a post from Cactus MY from September 17, 1995. At the time, Shawn was in the middle of his third and final run as the Intercontinental Champion. The title of the post: What the Hell is Hickenbottom Trying to Do? Make Us Sick? When the WWF fans are about 90% to 10% men, why have Shawn strip? Makes me sick. So, I guess Cactus was no fan of Shawn Michaels and his strip teases. Lisa Nelson had a different view. Do you really think the men and women ratio in pro wrestling is that big? I don't think so. As being a fan for the last 10 years, I've seen women increase in great numbers during the matches, or at the matches. As a woman, Michaels' butt-shaking is great. He's extremely good-looking and has a nice butt to boot. Now, I wonder what the reaction would be if a man posted something on Twitter these days about Becky Lynch or Sasha Banks like this. He would be called a pig so quickly the tweet would be posted not 10 seconds later. It is interesting, the double standard, I do have to say. But anyway, Lisa goes on. Vince must think so too, otherwise this wouldn't be going on now, would it? Ah, to dream that maybe the WWF will produce an R-rated video of Shawn doing other things. Vince would potentially have a gold mine at his feet. Lisa could hardly contain herself. Chris Quigley chimes in. He says, my sister prefers Bret Hart to Shawn Michaels. She says Shawn ranks up there right after John Bon Jovi and the guy who played Zack on Saved by the Bell. I love Shawn Michaels being ranked behind Zack Morris from Saved by the Bell. See, me personally, I was always a Lark Voorhees guy myself. I always had a thing for Lisa Turtle. Then we have what may be my favorite of the posts this week. From John Curtis Holmes on May 18, 1996. The day before the infamous curtain call at Madison Square Garden. This was the day before the curtain call at MSG. In a post titled, The Reason for Shawn Michaels' Jealousy. I think I figured out why so many of the male contingent of RSPW hates Shawn Michaels so much. I think they're just jealous because all the girls love him and because of his looks. As a result, all the guys are jealous of Shawn because they wish they could look like him. I have a problem similar to Shawn's. I, too, am a very good-looking male. And so many other guys at school are jealous of me because all the girls want me. I don't have an arrogant attitude, and I'm not cocky about my good looks, but guys seem to resent my ability to attract women. I've had a lot of girlfriends, and I've been nice to all of them, but why are guys so jealous of me because of it? I think Shawn Michaels has the same problem that I do. Regardless of his impressive work rate and his charisma, some guys just resent him because he gets the females like I do. This is my opinion on why so much of RSPW, very male-oriented, dislike Shawn as champion. He's got it all, much like I do, and some people are just jealous of that. He's really worked hard to fulfill the dream of a 12-year-old boy, and I wish you guys would cut him some slack. A bunch of you will probably want to flame me for my opinion, but if you do, then it's just further proof that you're jealous of me because I am a ladies' man. Basically, they hate us because they ain't us, is what he's saying. John has a very high opinion of himself. It's got to be hard, man, right? Walking around like that, looking good. I feel so sorry. I wish these guys would, back then in, what was this, 96? If they had a GoFundMe, I would have contributed to this guy's GoFundMe. Chris responds, but Shawn is not that good looking. I mean, for a wrestler, Maybe the girls would find him attractive, but how many good-looking male wrestlers are there? Really, none. There are about three that could pass off as above-average-looking human beings. Shawn, Brett, and Leif Cassidy. Shawn Michaels has one eyebrow across his forehead, hair like a girl, a strange-looking mouth, etc. What does that even mean? A strange-looking mouth. Why is he looking at his mouth? Anyway. For a wrestler, he may be the Heartbreak Kid, but in the real world? Ha! I love that. Unibrow HBK. The fact that Chris lumped Al Snow into this list of most good-looking male wrestlers makes me think that Al was lurking on RSPW in 1996 under the name Chris. A few days later, on May 23rd, Phillips responded and disagreed with Chris's assessment. The anonymous wrestling fan who died last year, leaving Shawn Michaels $2.5 million in his or her will, would probably disagree with that assessment. And the women who approached Shawn in the club in Syracuse, which sparked the attack, would agree as well. Unless it was the 1-2-3 kid that they were after. Of course, Syracuse is... And I tried to find some posts about that, but, you know, that was the attack in 95 where Shawn was beaten up in the club. But the inheritance story, I wanted to just take a moment here to talk a little bit about that. That inheritance story is true. At least the story is. Shawn himself has never confirmed it, but he's also never denied it. It was first mentioned, I wanted to go back and see, when was this story first mentioned? How did this story originate? And from what I can ascertain, this story was first mentioned on a wrestling hotline that Shawn Michaels had inherited $2.5 million from a wrestling fan that he did not know who had passed away. And I guess they left their money or their estate to him. Dave Meltzer then chimed in. He reported on it in the January 15th, 1996 issue of the Wrestling Observer. He said that Michaels had hoped to keep the whole thing quiet. He wasn't happy that it got out. It actually happened a few months earlier. Bruce Pritchard, I can tell you that, you know, Bruce Pritchard mentioned this on one of his podcasts with Conrad a couple of years ago. They had done a show on Scott Hall. But on the show, Pritchard seemed to think that it happened a lot earlier. So timeline-wise, according to Pritchard, this would have happened in 93, around the time that Shawn had quit the company after failing a drug test. Instead of paying the fine, he decided to just go ahead and quit, and they had to strip him of the Intercontinental Championship. It's possible that Pritchard just has his timeline wrong on this, because by all accounts, this is something that would have happened probably in 95. WWE held a press conference in January of 96. If you remember, you know, in kayfabe on TV, they had his doctor, Shawn's doctor, you know, talking about his condition and his comeback. This was after he had the post-concussion syndrome angle with Owen Hart. They said, oh, he came back too quickly, and he collapsed, and it was post-concussion syndrome. And they were just trying to build up sympathy for him to come back and win the Royal Rumble and go on to win the championship. Health-wise, you know, he was fine. He got the shit kicked out of him by those Marines in September, but he healed up. He was fine. But they had a press conference this you know, I figured it was just all for entertainment, but maybe they had actual media members there. In January of 96, to announce his comeback at the Royal Rumble, and somebody asked him at the press conference about this whole inheritance story. And this was, again, in the Observer at the time. They say that when he got asked the question, Shawn got very angry and very defensive, and he said, no comment. And don't ever bring that up again. So I think there definitely is smoke to the fire. Again, I don't think I've ever heard Michaels address it and confirm the story, but I don't think he's ever denied it. I don't know if he took the money. I don't know if he did not take the money. But that inheritance story has been around for a very long time. It's funny to see people back in 95 and 96 talking about it here on RSPW. June 3rd, 1996... a post by Ken, titled, Who Almost Killed Shawn Michaels? I am in the fourth grade. I am trying to find the answer for this trivia question. Who almost killed Shawn Michaels in Syracuse, New York, 3 years ago? John tried to help out this young man. He said, it was 9 thugs with military-style haircuts. They were very bad men. They jumped Sean after he was at a nightclub. Do you know what a nightclub is? It's a place where people go to unwind and drink, which is illegal for you to do. Listen to your parents when they tell you not to stay out late at night. If Sean had a curfew, like you probably do, little Kenny, he wouldn't have gotten into trouble that night in Syracuse. Oh, by the way, it wasn't 3 years ago. It was less than a year ago. I'm glad I could help. Good luck in school, and always do your homework and eat your vegetables. By the way, how about that, Sonny? Wouldn't you just like to? And then he put dot, dot, dot. He said, oh, what the hell? RSPW has gone to hell, so I can't make it any worse. So that comes from John. We then skip ahead to November 22nd, 1996. A post from Michael, titled, Shawn Michaels Getting Booed at Survivor Series. I was kind of baffled that because Shawn got booed at MSG, everyone here on RSPW thinks he should just turn heel. I mean, it's not as if Shawn was getting booed while fighting a heel. He was fighting Sid, who was one of the top 3 faces in the promotion. Bret Hart got booed when he was fighting Undertaker last year. Hulk Hogan got booed when he eliminated Sid Justice at the Royal Rumble a few years back. Am I the only one who thinks RSPW is overreacting to Shawn's reception at Survivor Series? Wrestling fans overreacting? Pfft, come on! Never! That would never happen. He continues. He says, funny, because I went to an MSG house show in August and Shawn got the most humongous pop I had ever heard at a house show. It was absolutely amazing. I just don't get why so many people are so negative about him. He goes out, he works incredibly hard, and seemingly always wrestles the best match on the show. So even back in 96, we have wrestling fans complaining about the fickle nature of other wrestling fans when it comes to the top guys. I do think Michael makes a great point, though. You know, Shawn was wrestling Sid. And Sid, when he came back in 96 after the Ultimate Warrior left or got fired, was over to a ridiculous degree with the audience. I don't know that it ever really translated to big business. I don't know that Sid, you know, was selling out the houses and selling tons of merch and making a big difference in that respect. But when he would walk out, they were loud. And he would do the fist bump, and he would tell, who's the man? And they would say, you're the man. And he was just the coolest thing at the time on television. I mean, you tell me, who came off as cooler that night in Madison Square Garden? Sid? Or the Chippendales dancing guy with Jose the grandfather in his corner? I mean, let's be honest. It was Sid. I do have one last Shawn Michaels-related post, but before I get to it, in doing my research this week, I came across a post about another Click member, a fellow friend of Shawn's, and it is a post that caught my eye from December 2nd, 1996, and I had to think twice before opening it. The title was Nash's Shaft. I had 2 options. I could continue scrolling past it and have to live with the mystery for the rest of my life about what the hell this was about, or I could just say fuck it and open it. So of course I decided to open it. In order to protect the identity of the poster, I will not use their name, but I will tell you that their email address indicates they had, at the time, attended Brown University. So this was a student. This is what it said. I haven't read anything about this yet, but did anyone else think that Nash's version of Shaft, while doing the play-by-play on NWO Saturday Night, was the funniest thing they heard on a wrestling program in years? He's a complicated man, and no one understands him but the giant, Hall, Scott Hall. All of these Nash back to WWF rumors make no sense. He seems to be having the time of his life. As part of the NWO, what reasons would he have to leave? He rarely has to wrestle, and he never has to job. He also gets to show his humorous side that Vince never took advantage of when he was Diesel. Whew. I was mentally prepared to be scarred for life when I opened that post. So I dodged a bullet there. I wasn't the only one who felt that way. Viz H says, and here I thought this thread would be about something important to RSPWers, like the size of Nash's shaft. So from Nash's shaft, we skip ahead to one last post. From March 20th, 1997, by Mark Jensen, a post titled, Shawn Michaels Makes Me Sick. Well, this sounds encouraging. This was after Shawn lost his smile. He's found his smile. Let's see, he didn't have the job to Bret at WrestleMania. Bret is now a mega heel, and Shawn is left as one of the biggest baby faces in all of wrestling. Yeah, I'm sure he's found his smile. He didn't want to do a job to Dean Douglas, and he did not want to do a job to Bret. Now there's a real professional. Vince's smile from ear to ear on Raw is the straw that broke the camel's back. Why didn't you just bend over and ask Shawn to fuck you up the ass, Vince? Fuck you, Shawn Michaels. You make me sick. The Maritimer says, same here. I'm just glad I was able to do something about it when I was in Syracuse back in the fall of 95, because a bunch of us... never mind. That comes from the Maritimer. Dave says, Shawn Michaels makes me sick too. I rarely post to RSPW, but this got me thinking. Where did Michaels as champion get the WWF? Just ask Nitro, they'll tell you. I've been a diehard fan for 15 years and I'll never switch to WCW, but Vince makes it awfully tempting. He ran Raw into the ground with Michaels, turned off many of the male fans with this stripper boy, and now he's giving him a push again? I'll go along with Bret on this one. Bret has given his all for 12 years. 12 WrestleManias, I believe. And McMahon thinks it's funny to have his boy toy lead the pack. Sorry, but Bret has given his all and was not ashamed to job to Sid. Well, I'll correct Dave here. He specifically says in his entrance music that he is not your boy toy. I just had to make that correction. Where's Michael's knee injury? If it's a legitimate injury, keep him off camera. If it's drugs, or if Michaels is too much of a crybaby to job, then he has no right to be there. I know it's all scripted, but Vince, you can do better. Bret's legacy deserves it. Sign Bret. I mean Dave. It sure sounds like something Bret would say. But that comes from Dave. And there you have it. Shawn Michaels, making people sick since 1997. I got some mailbag questions. You can always email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. David in Sacramento. Kofi must retain against Brock Lesnar, says the subject line. With Kofi Kingston versus Brock Lesnar happening on SmackDown this Friday, basically everyone is saying that Kofi is dropping the championship that night. But the following month is Survivor Series, and with the likelihood of The Fiend defeating Seth Rollins at Hell in a Cell, that would lead to Brock Lesnar against The Fiend, a match I 100% can guarantee Brock would win. How would you feel if a returning Bobby Lashley cost Brock the championship similar to how Goldberg did when Brock took on Eddie Guerrero? This would finally set up Lashley versus Lesnar, give Kofi a major win, and lead to Kofi against The Fiend at Survivor Series, and more importantly, have Kofi eventually drop it to a full-timer instead of part-time Brock. Lashley had elbow surgery. He's not due back until early November, so that would make it very unlikely that he would be cleared to do anything this week. Nor do I see how that helps Kofi, or makes Kofi look stronger if he needs to rely on interference from someone, you know, someone else, to keep his championship. And maybe the New Day gets involved. You know, they're his brothers. Maybe they help him. I'm just saying, I don't, you know, if the idea is, you know, you want Kofi to kind of come off as his own man, or if he's going to go down, he'll go down swinging without anybody's help. I'm not sure how having somebody interfere and save Kofi, save his championship, excuse me, really does anything to make Kofi look strong. I'm not really a fan of that idea. Wesley from Miami. What if WWE took a top guy like John Cena and had him make disparaging comments in an interview about the 24/7 title, only to be confronted by R-Truth, slamming back saying he neither understands or has what it takes to become the 24/7 champion? This would lead John Cena on a quest to win the belt. After failing several times, he seeks out coaching from the past 24 champions, and finally wins the big one, then loses it quickly, of course. This would maybe help add more prestige to the title and keep people from calling it a belt for jabrones only. What do you think? I think that would be a terrible idea. Why would you take a top attraction like John Cena or some other person and use him for something like that? You're not elevating the 24/7 title. You're damaging whatever star power the other person has by even associating them with this nonsense. The whole point of the 24/7 title is that it's for entertainment value. It is meant to be a joke. It is not meant to be taken seriously. It is completely one-dimensional. Every week they send a bunch of people out running after it or running through the hallway after it. And there's no thought given to anything else, because that's not why the title exists. You're giving this more thought than they have. To take it seriously would defeat the entire purpose of the championship in the first place. You know, you've got 9 other titles between Raw and SmackDown. We're not even counting NXT. Between Raw and SmackDown, you have 9 championships that should be taken seriously. 2 top titles, 2 mid-card titles, 2 women's titles, and 3 sets of tag team belts. Those should be taken seriously. The 24/7 title is not meant to be taken seriously. And someone like John Cena should be kept as far away from it as possible. Or if you want to do a funny little cameo where he happens to be back on TV and R-Truth is standing next to him and he rolls him up and it's just something done for a laugh and they quickly get it off him. I mean, that's fine. But you're proposing this whole elaborate storyline. And again, I'm not shitting on you. I'm just saying the idea, I think it's a terrible idea. I would never, ever do anything like that. You know, the reason that it works for R-Truth is because R-Truth is funny. He's entertaining. He makes people laugh. He's the perfect fit for that title. And that's the way that it should stay. Brad in San Jose, California. Do you think that there's a chance Triple H will sign Kylie Rae to an NXT contract since she parted ways with AEW? It was announced that she's back on the independent scene. What say you? She is back. That's true. I saw the video of her making her entrance. She got a huge pop. She seemed happy. Apparently she had a really good match. I think she was wrestling her husband or boyfriend or whatever their relationship is. It was an intergender match and apparently it was very good. And of course he put her over. Because that's what you do, right? You don't want to hear the headaches if you don't. Play politics, I don't want to lose to her. Then you got to go home with her. It's probably a bad situation. So anyway, she is back. I would love to know the story behind what happened with AEW. I guess if she wants to tell that story one day, then she'll tell that story. Without knowing what happened, it's hard to say if she would even want to go to NXT. I'm thinking it might be best to kind of leave that one alone, unless she inquires on her own. If she sends out feelers about wanting to get a tryout and go to NXT, then by all means, you know, I would give her a look. But, you know, they have these tryout camps every few months, then she could certainly sign up to do one of those. Like Eva Lise. They had Eva Lise do a tryout camp a number of months ago. She didn't get picked. But they could do something like that with Kylie Rae. Otherwise, I would just leave well enough alone, because I don't know what her situation and where her head is at as far as where she wants to go and what she wants to do. Chris, in Green Bay, Wisconsin, if WWE would never have cleared Daniel Bryan to wrestle again, do you think he would have ended up in AEW? And if so, would he be their top star, similar to what Chris Jericho is now? I don't know if he would have ended up in AEW, but he absolutely would have had a run in CMLL in Mexico, and he would have had a run in New Japan. He was openly talking about how Blue Panther was one of his favorite wrestlers and how he wanted to do a hair versus hair match against him in Arena Mexico. That was like a dream of his. I think we would have gotten the Bryan Danielson World Tour for a little while. He would have probably ended up in the G1 like Jon Moxley did this year. And if AEW wanted him bad enough, I'm sure WWE would have had a change of heart real quick about letting him wrestle again, and there would have been a bidding war. I still think Jericho would have been recruited to be their top star. But, you know, he would have been... because he has more name recognition than Brian does. So I think Jericho would have been in the same spot he's in now. But he would have been... I think Brian would have been a number two if they wanted him bad enough. He loves to wrestle. There was no way that he was re-signing with WWE, I don't think, if they were not going to clear him or give him assurances that they would be open to him wrestling again. If he felt he could still go, he even said, his wife, you know, Brie, said, listen, you do what you got to do. If you feel you can still go, if wrestling's in your heart and that's what you want to do, I will support you in anything that you want to do. He already had it in his head that he had one foot out the door. Which is why it's very convenient that all of a sudden he was able to convince them to let him wrestle again. It's funny how that works. So believe me, if he knew that they weren't going to let him wrestle, he would have gone out the door so fast there would have been a plume of smoke behind him, like in those cartoons. James from Staten Island. I was reading through some old news about WWF house shows in 1996, and I remember reading about a show called WWF Experience. One of the matches listed was Undertaker against Mankind in a casket match. We've seen those two have several gimmick matches, but I don't ever recall seeing them in a casket match. Do you know anything about this show, and did this actually take place? Well, today's your lucky day. Not only did it take place, Mankind and The Undertaker actually had a series of casket matches between July and September of 1996. They never aired on TV. It was all house shows. It was all live events. This one in particular was from a show called WWF Experience. From August 24th, 1996, CNE Stadium in Toronto. There have been rumors over the years that this was the first ever iPay-per-view produced by WWE, and it aired online. To the best of my knowledge, that is bullshit. I have found no evidence that that actually happened. I'm not even sure how the show would have streamed in 1996 on a dial-up connection. Very slowly, I would assume. I mean, it would take 30 seconds just to load a picture back then. Forget streaming an entire show. I don't see how that would have been possible. It would have been more of a slideshow. That's what it would have been. It would have been a slideshow. What it was a giant house show. The X in the Experience name represented 10, as in 10 years since WWE last ran that building, which was in 1986, for the big event. Which I believe the big event might be on the WWE Network. That was the show that was headlined by Hulk Hogan against Paul Orndorff in the main event. That show had almost 70,000 people in the building. It was like a WrestleMania. 10 years later, they were able to get, I think for this they had about 20,000 or so, which for that period of WWE had to be considered good. It was a sold show. So they were paid in advance to put the show on, so they already got their money. It was part of this thing called the CNE Fair in Toronto, which explains why they were able to probably get 20,000 people in the building if they had a giant fair going on. I remember seeing pictures in the WWF magazine from the show, specifically Shawn Michaels wrestling Goldust in a ladder match. They did the spot where Goldust pulled down Shawn's trunks, and you could see his bare ass. I mean, Anyway, so it was a ladder match for the championship. They had still shots in the magazine of it. On YouTube, the only thing that you'll find is actually video of that ladder match. So if you want to watch the Shawn Michaels Goldust ladder match for the title, it's like 17 or 18 minutes, you can find it. It's not the greatest quality. It's fan cam, but it's on YouTube. However, I have a treat for all of you. You can watch the full show. Or nearly the full show. I think it may be missing the first two matches. But you can watch the full show online right now. I'm sure WWE, they must have filmed this. Maybe one day they'll end up adding it to the network as a hidden gem. Maybe. I mean, you know, the whole Bret Hart, Tom McGee thing. It took somebody else getting the footage and probably threatening to put it online for them to actually put it on their own network finally. Maybe they get wind of this and they'll finally add this to the network too. But you can watch it online right now. This is the only way that you can see this show. It is fan cam footage. So it was shot. This is the difference, I guess, between something like this and the Bret Hart Tom McGee thing. The Bret Hart Tom McGee thing, that was shot by WWE. And it had commentary, I think, from Monsoon and Heenan. This was not shot by WWE. This was a fan cam video of the entire show. And I will say that for fan cam footage, I know that turns some people off. Oh, it's crappy quality. You know what? For being a handheld, it's pretty good quality for a fan cam. There's a little bit of shaky cam at times, but not nearly as much shaky cam as you'll see today on WWE television. It's got a Jim Cornette, Jose Lothario match that doesn't go very long. There's a lumberjack match between Psycho Sid and Vader, with members of the Toronto Argonauts football team as lumberjacks wearing their uniforms. Yeah, I saw an Argonauts game once. I was actually at Sky Dome. Inside Sky Dome, this had to be, I'm thinking, 93 or 94. I saw a Toronto Argonauts game. In fact, I still have my ticket stub laying around here somewhere. So that was kind of interesting, seeing the Argonauts on the outside of the ring for the lumberjack match. There's a match between Stone Cold and Mark Marrow. And the Undertaker-Mankind casket match in question is on there. And the ladder match with Shawn and Goldust. It's pretty rare stuff. Pretty rare stuff. This, from what I understand, this video may have been years ago on YouTube. And it was quickly taken down, or the account that it was under was terminated, and so the video vanished. But it has since found a new home on a different server. You will not find this show on YouTube. I will link everybody to the video on my Twitter page as soon as I am done recording. So, at Solomonster is my handle. If you want to watch it, I will link to it. Taran from Detroit. Buy or sell on which era of Gold Dust was the best? The mid to late 90s, the 2000s, or the 2010s? In ring, it's the 2010s. Character-wise, what made the Goldust character so memorable and so controversial at the time were those early years in the mid-90s. Mainly 96 and 97. You know, the feud with Razor Ramon, that was a memorable one. The WrestleMania match, the backlot brawl with Roddy Piper. The feud with Ahmed Johnson. Yeah, even the feud with the Ultimate Warrior. The match was nothing, but you know, those were segments with the Warrior. I mean, forget it. I mean, it would offend everybody today if they aired, and it's you could see why when you go back and watch them, some of the language he was using. But it was a side of the Warrior character that we hadn't seen before, and Goldust was trying to play mind games with him and come on to him, and so that was memorable. The feud with Ahmed Johnson was memorable. You know, Goldust was also part of that classic 10-man tag at Canadian Stampede in 97 against the Hart family. For me, between the mid-90s and the 2010s, that's really what it's between. You know, the early 2000s, I like the funny stuff he did with Booker T, but that's not his best era. So I'm going to buy on the mid-90s, because those are the most memorable years of the Goldust character for me. But the matches that he had with Randy Orton and with Cody against The Shield at that Battleground show in 2013, I mean, those were great. I mean, that Battleground match with Dusty in their corner, and then they win, and the crowd goes crazy, and they all embrace with their dad, and they're crying. That was everything I love about pro wrestling. Was all rolled up into that one match. But I'm going to buy on mid-90s Goldust. For over a month now, I have been counting down the 8 best matches from my list in the career of Rey Mysterio, building to the finale here on Sound Off episode 619. I saved the final 2 matches for this episode, instead of doing just one, to try to make it a little less obvious what number 1 is. So we'll start with number 2. When the World Tag Team titles were made exclusive to Monday Night Raw in 2002, Stephanie McMahon, who at the time was the general manager of SmackDown, announced a tournament to crown new WWE Tag Team Champions. Los Guerreros beat Mark Henry and Rikishi to advance. Kurt Angle and Chris Benoit, reluctant partners. They teamed up to beat John Cena and Billy Kidman. Reverend Devon and Farouk beat Billy and Chuck. And Edge teamed up with Rey Mysterio in the opening round to beat the team of I can't even believe I'm saying this, but it's true. Brock Lesnar and Tajiri. Lesnar was the undisputed champion at the time, so he didn't really care. Edge and Mysterio, they advanced to beat D-Von and Farouk to earn a spot in the finals against Angle and Benoit. And that match is number two in the countdown. Arguably WWE's match of the year in 2002 and one of the greatest tag team matches that I have ever seen. To crown new WWE tag team champions, Kurt Angle and Chris Benoit against Edge and Rey Mysterio from No Mercy 2002. This match and the Hell in a Cell match later that night between Brock Lesnar and The Undertaker were the highlights of an otherwise very forgettable No Mercy pay-per-view. Angle and Benoit were locked in a feud at the time, and Stephanie said, if you guys are not able to coexist, and if you get physical with each other, if you can't get along, I'm going to suspend you for a year without pay. She wanted them to work together to help make the tag team division, as she called it, more legitimate. So that was the story with them going into the show. Edge, at the time, was really coming into his own as a singles performer. He had a couple of really good pay-per-view matches earlier in the year against Kurt Angle, and I think some TV matches as well, including the one, Judgment Day match, where he shaved Angle bald. Angle had a great no-DQ match, or Edge did, I should say, not Angle, but Edge had a great no-disqualification match on SmackDown in the weeks leading up to this against Eddie Guerrero. That was a very good match. I believe that might have been the match where Edge actually first suffered the neck injury that led to him getting spinal fusion before WrestleMania the following year, and that kept him out for over a year. So the timing for him was awful because he was just coming into his own. He was having some great matches as a single star, and then boom, his body fails him and he misses over a year. And in wrestling, you know, that's a lifetime. That really is a lifetime. Ironically, when he came back, he became tag team champion with Chris Benoit, although it was on Raw and not SmackDown. And he was all jacked up, all muscled up. I think he may have even admitted since then that he was taking things he shouldn't have been taking. I mean, he looked just way more muscular than I've ever seen him at any other point in his career. But that was when he came back in 04. Rey, at this time, was still relatively new to the company. He had only been on TV about 3 months by this point. He lost to Kurt in that great opener at SummerSlam, which opened this countdown, in fact. The striking thing about going back and watching this match is how intense it felt. They were really laying it in, Benoit and Angle in particular. This felt like a fight. This didn't feel like a performance. It felt like a fight. We got what I always refer to as the Angle kickout, where he waits about a second too long before getting the shoulder up. So much so to the point that the crowd actually boos when the referee has to hold up the count and they chant bullshit. That didn't happen here, but it was just a staple of Angle's matches. Maybe the worst one I can ever remember was his match with Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 21, which was an outstanding match and probably one of the greatest WrestleMania matches of all time. It's the match that Bobby Heenan said that was the greatest match he had ever seen. And in that match, after Shawn super kicks him, there's this great spot where Angle is yelling at him and just telling him, stay down, stay down. And Shawn just out of nowhere lays a super kick in, knocks him out. When he finally crawls over to go for the pin, Kurt just waits a second too long. And it just, you know, it had to be done on purpose because he did it in almost every match. So this match was no different. We got the obligatory, what I call Angle kickout spot. Rey gave Angle a Rana off the top rope. Benoit then accidentally nailed Kurt with the diving headbutt. Edge went for the cover. We got an Angle kickout for a damn near fall. Benoit had Edge trapped in the crossface. Mysterio delivered a 619 to break it up. He nailed Benoit right in the face as he had Edge at this hole. That may have been the best 619 I've ever seen. Mysterio gets caught by an Angle slam. Kurt goes for the ankle lock to Edge. Edge kicks him off into the ropes. Angle bounces off the ropes, and Edge rolls him up inside cradle for a near fall. And the people were losing their minds. The fans were absolutely going out of their minds after that near fall. Edge hits a spear. Benoit breaks up the pin. Mysterio knocks Benoit out to the floor with a baseball slide. Kurt with the ankle lock on Edge. Edge reverses into an ankle lock of his own. Kurt reverses back into the ankle lock, and finally Edge taps out. Kurt Angle and Chris Benoit are your new WWE Tag Team Champions. I don't do star ratings. That's kind of just not my thing. But I'll make an exception here. This was a 5-star match. This was excellent. Edge and Mysterio, they did go on to win the tag team titles from Angle and Benoit a couple weeks later in a 2-out-of-3 falls match on SmackDown. Then they dropped them at Survivor Series right after that to Eddie and Chavo. Which brings us to the number one match in the countdown, the greatest match in the career of Rey Mysterio. If you listen to my countdown of the top 15 matches in WCW history, I did this a few years ago, probably 2015. And this, the whole point of doing that was we were building to the anniversary of the death of WCW. I think it was it might have been the 15-year anniversary. That's why I did a top 15. And so I did this countdown. I started it in December, and it built all the way to March of what I thought were the 15 best matches in the Turner era of World Championship Wrestling. And this match was on that list. Now, that was not a ranked list like this one is. But this next match was on that list. It is an all-time classic. It is Rey Mysterio against Eddie Guerrero. Mask versus title for the WCW Cruiserweight Championship at Halloween Havoc, October 26, 1997, from the MGM Grand Garden Arena in Las Vegas. Our second mask versus title match in this countdown, the first being from The Bash in 2009, Mysterio against Chris Jericho. Tony Schiavone on commentary called this one of the greatest pay-per-view title matches in history. Rey was very smart. He wore a full body suit with the mask attached for this mask, for this match rather. It was a purple onesie. I don't think he ever wore it again after this. Probably because Eddie was ripping at it and destroyed it. But he wore this full body suit, which made it nearly impossible to rip the mask off. Although that didn't stop Eddie Guerrero from trying. But I mean, it's like Kane wearing both sleeves for his first blood match with Stone Cold at the King of the Ring in 98. Full sleeves and a mask. I can't imagine why Austin lost. So 1997 was really the year that Eddie Guerrero came out of his shell as a performer in WCW. Here, you know, one of the things when you go back and watch this match, and it may be surprising, you may have people watching this going, well, what's the big deal? I mean, it's kind of slow. It is. The beginning of the match, they slowed it down. You know, Eddie slowed it down with some submission hold attempts. Because people may just assume, well, this match was just 15 minutes of balls to the wall, nonstop action, no time to breathe. Not the case. They took their time. They built a story. They let the match build. It wasn't just nonstop moves and flips for 15 minutes. Everything meant something. Now, and I talked about there being a crowd these days. Three's a crowd when it comes to the announce teams. Well, we had four announcers at the desk here in this match. Tony Schiavone, Dusty Rhodes, Bobby Heenan, and Mike Tenay. And thank God they had Tenay out there because the other three were clueless. When it came to a lot of the holds and the history, it did give us this gem, though. After a head scissors near the end of the match that took Eddie out over the top rope, what athleticism, said Dusty Rhodes. Not athleticism. What athleticism, according to Dusty Rhodes. Tony had a good laugh at that. I think we all did. Eddie just destroyed Rey with this ferocious powerbomb into a pin attempt for a near fall. They did the Splash Mountain finish off the top rope with Rey countering the crucifix powerbomb into a Rana on the way down. Rey wins the Cruiserweight Championship. It's best that I think you go back and watch for yourself, watch the rest of this match. There's a reason that I have this in number one. As of about an hour before the match, Eddie Guerrero was scheduled to win and retain the championship, which meant that Rey Mysterio would have to lose his mask. There was a lot of drama going on behind the scenes because Rey did not want to lose his mask. Now, eventually, He lost that battle. I think it was in 99, and he ended up unmasking on Nitro. He didn't want to do that either. But in 97, Ray was still relatively new to WCW. You know, he had only debuted there in 96. There was probably a lot of money to be made in toys and masks and other merch. I don't know that WCW was doing any of that. I know WCW had some merch. I know they had t-shirts. I know the stories of, you know, Chris Jericho, I think in one of his books, when he would see the receipts and somebody would buy a Jericho shirt, it was being rung up as a Hulk Hogan shirt, and Hogan was getting all this merch money. I've heard those stories. But I don't think WCW ever really monetized things the way that they should have. I don't know that they ever made a Rey Mysterio mask or a Rey Mysterio doll. But to have all of that potential and just say, well, we're going to just have the guy take his mask off, seems kind of foolish. So Rey didn't want to lose his mask. And Eric Bischoff, you know, Eric Bischoff had no respect for the tradition of the masks and Lucha Libre, what they meant to these guys. He didn't seem to really give a shit. And Ray told this story last year on Chris Jericho's podcast. Actually, might have been earlier this year. On the Jericho Cruise, they did a tribute to Eddie Guerrero podcast. He said that he was talking to Conan at the time. Conan was telling him, don't go to the show. Tell them you're hurt. Don't go to the show. Ray then gets a call from Eric Bischoff at home because somehow Bischoff found out that Ray was planning on not coming. Somebody snitched. And Eric tells him, if you don't show up, you're going to be in breach of contract. And you know what that means. So Ray freaked out. He said, well, damn, I better get my ass to the show. He gets there. He's looking around for Bischoff. He wants to talk to Eric. You know, he wants to try to convince him. One last ditch effort to convince him not to lose the mask. And he can't find Eric anywhere. So now it's 20 minutes before the match. Arn Anderson was the agent. He comes over. He says, the finish has changed. Ray's going over. And Eddie had told, you know, before this, Eddie had told Ray, look, we don't have to do the match if you don't want to. He was ready to back up his friend 100%. But Ray said, no, 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 let's put the match together. So then Arn comes in and tells him that the finish was changed. And now Ray's, he's probably happy that he's going over now, but now he's nervous. Because they're 20 minutes out from this match. He's like, what are we going to do, Eddie? What are we going to do? And Eddie just says to him, just shut up and listen to me. Just listen to me out there. And Ray said that's what he did. And Eddie made him look like $1 million. And then he lost it right back to Eddie on Nitro 2 weeks later. But for that night, Ray went over and he became the new Cruiserweight Champion. So there was high drama behind the scenes building up to what is absolutely one of the greatest matches and greatest championship matches in WCW history. And in my opinion, the single greatest match in the career of Rey Mysterio. So that was fun. I enjoyed going down memory lane and going through some of these old Ray matches. I'll have these two archived on the YouTube channel. I put all the segments, all the matches in one playlist. If you want to go back and hear me talk about the other matches in the countdown, you could find one big playlist there on the YouTube channel. Please sub to the channel if you're not already subbed. Considering what's going to be going up on the channel this week, there's never been a better time to subscribe and make sure that you get notified of any and all new content, live streams that may be taking place this week between now and the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view next Sunday. So go to YouTube, type in Solomonster Sounds Off, or just go to youtube.com/TheSolomonster, and that should take you to the official page. One last quick plug here. Big meetup coming up at the Monroe Pub in Brooklyn on Friday starting at 5 o'clock. I will be there from 5 to 7-ish. Before I head out to go watch SmackDown, but Draper will be there, JD will be there, Julian Cannon will be there. Draper at least is going to be hanging out with all you guys to watch SmackDown at the bar if you want to hang out there. It's going to be a fun night. There'll be giveaways, and use that Lyft code. If you're taking a Lyft or an Uber or something like that to the event or from Comic-Con to the bar from Manhattan to Brooklyn, sign up for a Lyft account. Use the code SOLOMONSTER. That'll get you some money off. Otherwise, that's it. I will see you guys on Wednesday night after AEW Dynamite on TNT live on YouTube. I'll have my predictions for Hell in a Cell up later in the week as well. I will see you back here for episode 620 of The Sound Off next Sunday, and that will be Hell in a Cell Sunday. Very busy week coming up. House of Glory on Saturday. Maybe I'll see some of you guys there as well. Be well. Stay safe. It's going to be fun. going to be busy. It's going to be fun. Take care, guys.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
Sasha Banks is back.
And Michael Cole could not contain his excitement.
Oh my, could it be? It is! It's boss time!
You know, he's been holding that in for 4 months. I'm surprised that he wasn't like a wind-up doll saying it over and over and over again.
It's boss time! It's boss time! It's boss time!
The Sala Monster sounds off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesalamonster for sound off extras and more. And follow the Sala Monster on Twitter @SalaMonster.
Sala Monster.
Sala Monster.
Put that cigarette out.
Sala Monster sounds off.